You can now relive the best moments of the UEFA Champions League 24/7. The UEFA Champions League channel is a new 24-hour streaming channel serving non-stop goals, highlights, and full match replays from the world's most prestigious club competition. Reminisce on your favorite moments, legendary players, and brilliant goals with the UEFA Champions League channel streaming around the clock on Pluto TV and the CBS Sports app.
Get fired up. Performance enhancing audio.
This is the State of Combat Podcast with Brian Campbell.
I'll live, I'll play, and I'll last. This is the State of Combat Podcast coming at you. Bonus edition this week. BC, your boy, the Brian Campbell, in your ear hole. Look, you know, I'm a company man. But even if I wasn't, I am a longtime fan of all things CBS staple for the past 20 years. Survivor, really the greatest game show, reality show, competition show, quasi-sport that keeps us coming back season after season. And I got one heck of a bonus podcast for you today. Looking at the show's history, treating this show rightfully as a sport, as a competition, who's best, who's better, who's everything, and, you know, some interviews, too, with some names you will know all too well today. It's going to be a long one, but it's going to be a great one. If you're a Survivor fan, even on the casual level, you're going to enjoy the insight, a little look at what it's really like to be on the island, you know, straight up. How bad do they smell? Where do they drop a deuce? There's a lot of questions we've always had. And also looking at the gameplay strategy, how it's evolved over the years. What is our lineup today? A trio of interviews, Bach to Bach to Bach. One of Survivor's most famous and popular players all time up first, Ethan Zahn. You know him. He's a winner of Survivor Season 3, Australia. And he played two more times, setting the record for the largest gap from 2004 to 2020 when he came back for this year's season 40, the ultimate all-star edition, if you will, almost the ultimate Super Bowl edition. We're going to hear from Ethan, two-time cancer survivor, talking about his history in the game, the celebrity he went through by winning season 3 back when, you know, the viewership totals were just through the roof. Even talk that celebrity relationship he had going for a short period with Jennifer Love Hewitt and more on that. And then we're going to throw it over to my CBS cohort. You know him as the host of the Nothing Personal podcast and digital video show on CBS Sports. It's David Sampson. You probably know him a little bit better as the former president of the Florida Miami Marlins, the Montreal Expos. He was also, if you forgot, on season of in 2014, Survivor Cagayan, unfortunately getting the boot when his tribe turned on him in the opening episode. We're going to talk about that, about what his experience was like, about, you know, how much that L still hurts, and if Sampson will ever come back and try again. And then I'm going to bring on a friend of the program that you know very well, Eric Raskin, boxing poker writer extraordinaire, also Survivor expert and super fan. He's seen every single season. Him and I have been trading emails, DMs, going back almost a decade on this show. He's going to come on, and we are definitively going to count down 40 seasons and 20 years in our rankings for the greatest players of all time, favorite, most lovable players of all time, biggest villains, hottest chicks, on and on, best seasons, all of that, how the game has evolved, how the strategy has evolved, how the game might continue to evolve to keep it on top where it is today as a staple in the, you know, reality TV competition game show setting there for CBS. Excited about this, fired up to bring it to you. Know you're going to enjoy it. Please, of course, continue to, you know, visit what we do on the SOC every week. We got you covered in boxing, MMA, UFC Hall of Famer, Rashad Evans, all that. Give us that 5-star review on Apple Pods or wherever, you know, Google Pods, wherever you are listening to this today. Spread that love forward. We hope you enjoy it. But it's Ethan Zahn, David Sampson, Eric Raskin coming your way after a quick pause for the cause. Get ready, all right? Put your buff on, okay? Your tribe has spoken. Let's do this.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The wait is over. The Chi returns with new episodes on Paramount Plus.
What brings you to the Chi?
Opportunity.
Everybody get down! Walk right up to
the side. A new rain is coming to the South Side.
Never should have sent a boy to do a woman's job.
The Chi. New episodes May 10th. Visit ParamountPlus.com/The Chi to get a 50% discount off the Paramount Plus with Showtime annual plan. Offer ends July 14th. Subscription auto renews. Restrictions apply.
All right, you know I'm a Survivor diehard, and I am fired up to finally get a true Survivor celebrity on this podcast. You know him as the winner of Season 3 Survivor Africa, a two-time cancer survivor, former pro soccer player, motivational speaker, reality TV star. It's Ethan Zahn. Ethan, I'm fired up for this at this moment. I know you're somewhere off in the woods enjoying life. How's it going, man?
Well, now I'm fired up because you're so fired up. And that was a spectacular introduction. So thank you. And it's great to be here chatting with you.
All right. It only goes downhill from here. That's fantastic. Look, here's why I got so excited about you joining the most recent season, a historic season, Season 40 Survivor, Winners at War, in a veritable all-star game. But really, I think the best one Survivor's ever put together in terms of getting the best of the best of the best. And that certainly includes you. But, you know, you were a record breaker. You hadn't been in the game for so long. I mean, it was the record for the longest gap. We saw you in 2004, Survivor All-Stars. That was Season 8, I believe. And now we see you again in 2020. This is like comparing, you know, George Mikan against Shaquille O'Neal in basketball terms, you know, how they match up. What was that like for you, considering how vastly the game had changed?
Oh man, yeah, it was like I was playing back in 2001. It was like we were playing underwater, you know. It was like slow motion Survivor, and then, you know, fast forward, like you said, many years, 16 years till I'm back on again, and it's like rocket fuel. This game is so fast paced. Information is passed so quickly. There's new clues and idols, ways to get back in the game, currency. It's just like a new experience altogether. It's like not better or worse. It's just different. And so, yeah, coming out of retirement after so long and getting myself back up to speed was a daunting task.
Look, so many families obviously can enjoy Survivor. I've got twin sons. They're 12 years old, and they're finally into it and loving it. And what I always try to explain to them is, you see that guy on the screen, Ethan, back when he won it, if you got one blindside a year, you'd be telling your friends about how awesome it was. Here, you're getting 2 to 3 blindsides an episode, it seems like. So it's certainly Survivor on steroids. I know that you got voted out early. It was young against old in a lot of ways. But did you feel like you could hang in this new environment?
Yeah, I think I could hang. I personally believe, you know, I'm going to be the guy saying, like, oh, back in the day, we used to walk to tribal council uphill both ways in the snow barefoot. That's what it was like back in the day. You know? But, like, the game, you know, the whole aspect of, the survival aspect of the game really was a non-factor. So, like, some of the skills that I, like, thought were important to the game just were insignificant at this point. You know, like, you know, being the provider, you know, honor, integrity, you know, providing for people, like just doing well in challenges. None of that matters anymore. It's like all about strategy and gameplay and just being uncomfortable for 39 days. And so getting out early was unfortunate because I had put in a lot of time, a lot of effort. I trained. I got myself ready mentally, physical, spiritually to go play this game. And then it just got cut short because of these slimy little impatient millennials That's what happened.
Millennials always ruining everything. Look, you played obviously a big part in season 40 because of the extra hook with the Edge of Extinction, the Bare Bones Island, and holy crap, Ethan, you went a long way. And just to kind of give us an understanding, when you compare what you normally have in Tribe, and you build up a shelter and you get food, you know, rewards, you get a lot of different things over the course of a season. What's Edge of Extinction like compared to that on the day to day, the grind?
The day to day, it is, it's the worst place on earth. It is purgatory. You are literally caught in between life and death in the game of Survivor. So for those who don't know what that is, when you're voted off Survivor in this current season, you don't go home. You go to this place called the Edge of Extinction. It's, you know, initials EOE, which I don't think many people know about. It actually stands for the end of Ethan is what that stands for, because that place literally is crushed your spirit. There's nothing happening. Maybe every few days you're getting a challenge. There's no food. There's no shelters. There's very limited ways to actually procure fish and food like that. So you're just sitting around starving to death, wishing you were back in the game or home, one of those two things. So it's a mental torture, and that's what they want. Like, that's what Probst wants. Like, they want to send you there to have this transformational experience, because the one thing that is incredibly difficult on the Edge of Extinction is there is a flagpole right in the middle of the island that you can see 24 hours a day. And if you just raise that flag, it's actually a sail. If you just raise that sail, you get to go home. Game over. You're eating your Doritos. You're drinking your Coca-Cola on the couch watching TV. But you can also try to stay, because you only have two more chances to get back in the game. So that daily torture of like debating whether you want to stay or go or play or not play is just maddening.
That's got to be intense. So, you know, we normally interview boxers, mixed martial arts, UFC champions, pro wrestlers on this show. Maybe not so much in the pro wrestling, but a lot of times we talk about the mental side, the mental warfare of it. And, you know, the ex-champions will tell you it's all mental. And I very so many times have said, like, you know, they're wired differently. The guys that can go in there and you know, we great UFC card this past weekend to see five rounds, 25 minutes of hellacious brawling. They're just wired differently. Well, Ethan, I say the same thing about you guys. And obviously your personal story adds into this, where, you know, you didn't just endure an insane Edge of Extinction. You've endured two bouts with Hodgkin's lymphoma and, you know, had been, I'm reading, in isolation for 260 days. I guess the basic way I can ask this is how are you wired for this element of of soul surviving, where it's all mental at the end of the day? What have you learned about how strong the human spirit can be in this process?
That's exactly, you know, what I learned. The game of Survivor for me has always been a mental game. You know, physically, I feel I've been okay. You know, I can get through to this moment. I've been a former professional soccer player. I've trained at a high level. Like, I knew what it takes to get yourself in shape physically. But the mental side of this game is, for me, torture. Because part of it, you know, you're making friends with these people and you're liking them and you're enjoying their company, but then you got to vote them off. So that's one whole thing. The other whole thing is going into this game where, you know, the elements are a factor. It is a real dilemma on a daily basis on how you're going to get through that day. So the mental side of the game is really huge. And for me, having been through a health challenge like cancer twice and being in isolation for 260 days, I learned a couple of things about myself is how far you can push the body. I actually feel I learned this on the first season of Survivor Africa, where the environment was just as horrible as the Edge of Extinction in terms of food, water, shelter. And we had the real threat to animals as well. So, like, I learned that you can really push your body to the absolute limit, and then you can push it even more. So, like, when I got into that, you know, my fight with cancer, I took the strategies that I learned kind of in Survivor and brought that to my fight against cancer. Obviously, I'm playing for $1 million, the other ones I'm playing for my life. But that mentality where there's a beginning, there's a middle, and an end, it's not necessarily a sprint. This is like a marathon. And so, like, yeah, I tapped into my innermost, you know, mental strength that I could possibly do to get through these moments. And there were some dark times there because, you know, going into the game with the I guess the weight and baggage of having a health challenge like cancer kind of started to drive me mad, because I got to a point where I was so depleted, and you're skinny, you're tired, you have no energy, you have no food. It's tough to get through a day. The last time I felt like that was when I was sick with cancer.
Right.
So like I instantly got shot back to this like PTSD moment. And I just started ruminating on these destructive thoughts where I'm like, I'm giving myself cancer again. What the frick is going on? Like, I'm killing myself. I got to get out of here. So to battle through that was torturous. And it's not like I can turn to someone and just say, hey, Boston Rob, like, I'm really feeling down and lonely right now. Can you help cheer me up? Like, no, you can't do that in Survivor because they're going to weaponize that information and use it against you at a later date. You're just stuck in your own self. So if you don't know yourself and you're not good at being alone by yourself, like, Survivor's not necessarily the game for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting about this whole crazy quarantine time is that in some ways, right, a lot of us are going through such an unprecedented feeling. I talk a lot on the show that, like, my job security is great. My family's great. I got a fenced-in backyard with dogs. I can walk to hiking trails. Thank God, you know, no one in my family's, had the COVID. I am not in a crazy apartment building where I can't get out because of the proximity of people. Yet with that said, it's a daily mental health challenge in many ways just to get through the crazy changes here. So if we're going to compare, I mean, it's all isolation in the end when you break away from your normal life. Could you give us any tips from your journey through life, through Survivor, that maybe can be applicable during this quarantine? Because I think a lot of us, whether we admit it or not, this ain't easy right now.
It's definitely not easy. And, you know, global pandemics change the world, and we don't really know the extent of how this one is going to change ours right now. And so, like, all this uncertainty is just driving us mad. And the uncertainty kind of creates anxiety. And something that I've learned through all my challenges is just something simple like acceptance. You know, the first step to controlling anything that's out of control is acceptance. Once you can accept that, then you can move on to the next phase, which is mapping out how you would like to live this next 6, 12, 18 months of your life. Like, I didn't want to accept that there's this bug inside my body trying to kill me, but I had to.
Right.
And I had to in order to be able to go on to, like, seriously plan how I want to live or survive these next part of my life. So my advice to folks out there is, like, once you can accept this, like I said, every challenge, every crisis has got a middle, a beginning, middle, and an end. And you just got to pace yourself, because once you can take care of yourself and make sure yourself and your family are safe, you got your structures and your systems in place, then you can start focusing on, you know, other people, focusing on your job, focusing on all that stuff. But the first step in all this is accepting what's going on in the world, because living in denial isn't helping anyone. You know, you can't deny what's going on, because that's just going to create destructive decisions and make you, you know, I always say, like, you can't necessarily keep a beach ball submerged underwater for really that long. Over an extended period of time, it's going to pop up in really weird ways. You're going to start doing things different, making, you know, stupid decisions. So you got to accept it. You got to acknowledge it, and then you're able to plan how you're going to live the next phase of your life.
I like that. I like that. My early strategy of too much beer and watching every war movie ever made, that didn't go well. Wife was not happy with the results of that one. I smell a book coming here, Ethan Zahn. All right?
I know you got a
motivational.
What's the title going to be?
Speaking background, if I had to guess, I'm thinking like Isolation Survival Guide.
I love it.
All right. Wait, is this
the isolation survival guy? Let's do it.
All right. I like that a lot. Great to hear. You've been cancer free since 2012. It's such a incredible, inspirational journey. It's weird because then you're able to use that journey and the fuel from that to play this crazy third trip around for Survivor. Did you ever believe at any point between 2004 and when you accepted this, through all the changes that happened in your life, from soccer to cancer, celebrity to regular life, that you'd be back doing this thing again?
No. Yes and no. Like, yes, in the sense that, like, I knew at some point, you know, Jeff Probst and Survivor crew, you know, they're going to do something big. There's going to be an all winners something. The Super Bowl is Super Bowl. It's got to happen. My issue was, like, I have so many health challenges. I didn't know if I'd ever be ready, you know, basically mentally and spiritually and physically to play this game. And I did get one call before to go back and play. And that was back in 2010. It was when they were doing Heroes versus Villains. But of course, I was sick. So I was literally inside my hospital room getting a second stem cell transplant, watching my friends on Survivor,
wow,
play this game. And I'm like, frick, if I get out of this thing alive, literally, I was that touch and go. If I get out of this alive, I'm going to get back. I'm going to play Survivor again. Took me 10 years to get to a point where I could say yes. And I did it. So for me, there's so many levels of, you know, goal setting and achieving that to get to this point. Just getting to the starting line of Survivor for me was like a win. Well, so for me, I kind of played the game in a bunch of different ways. You know, obviously I want to win and do well, but I have some like life moments that I wanted to achieve as well for being out there.
Yeah, I was going to ask that same question where you mentioned Edge of Extinction and Probst sort of shaping that as really like an opportunity to share feel-good stories of growth, and it works. I mean, you watch that show, you're touched by everyone's individual journey. Did you get the competitor side of you coming out at any point? Because like you said, obviously you want to win. It's a $2 million prize. Are you thinking at all about your Survivor legacy? Because this has become a, you know, 40 seasons in, this is like a pro sport. You know, we could, you know, we could, and many people do podcasts where you're counting down the greatest players as if we're looking at like the NBA or something. So was there a moment where you got back into the mode where you're like, I can win this thing. I want to win this thing. Boston Rob, you're going down, brother.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the first nine days of the game, when you're in it, I was, you know, 100%, 120% the whole time, really feeling I did have a good shot at going far in the game. I thought I liked my plan. I liked my alliances. I liked my strategy, and it just backfired because, you know, someone made a silly move. On the Edge of Extinction, when I first got there, I was ready. I was like, you know, high energy, ready to do this thing. But obviously, as more and more people get to the Edge of Extinction, and because I was there for the longest period of time, I'm the most depleted, it just became a little bit of a question, because you have these giant challenge beasts come. Boston Rob, you got Tyson, you got Yule, you got Wendell,
yes,
you know, you got Natalie, these people who are just have played a lot more recently than I have, and they're young and fit. Well, maybe not Rob, but so like you gotta, yes and no. Like I was understood my potential. However, I'm not the type of guy who's going to give up. And so for me, I just had to make a secondary plan of trying to go as hard as I could and just, like I said, achieve some goals for myself that were kind of like a subset of goals amongst the whole overarching, let's win this freaking thing. Because on the Edge of Extinction, there's 11 to 16 people competing for one spot to get back in the game. So, you know, statistics, you know, from sports, you know, not good shot for me. But at least I was there. I didn't give up. I stayed the whole time, and you know, I don't know, I didn't die. That was a good thing. I didn't die, and I think the production was worried about me at the time that I wasn't really gonna die.
Well, you've always been one of the more beloved players, so people are excited for you to come back. I have so many layman Survivor questions I'm sure so many people stop you with every day, but they always are showing, obviously, because they're editing down to an episode, strategy talk. But what's the, like, day-to-day talk, minute-to-minute like? I mean, are you guys are just pouring through and investing in each other's lives and talking about your favorite gas station food? And, I mean, like, we never hear any of that.
I know. There's so many things happening in the game these days that there's no time for, like, character development and just kind of learning a little bit more about who we are, how we interact with each other. At its core, like once you take away food, you take away water, you're tired, you're hungry, you're thirsty, Survivor is just a game of relationships. It's a bunch of people stuck in a horrible place, like connecting with each other in a lot of different ways. So on the Edge of Extinction, yeah, you're just literally, you're because there isn't much going on. You're learning about people, like what they're doing, what their jobs are, coming up with cockamamie inventions, you know. Obviously, you know, body fluid jokes everywhere. And like, you know, you're talking about food all the time, but it's boring. It is, you know, we say the days are long and the nights are longer. It gets dark at, you know, 5 p.m. and it doesn't get light until 6 a.m. and you're starving and you're just sitting around a fire doing nothing, trying to sleep, but you can't sleep. So boredom is a huge part of it. So like, it really isn't that much exciting stuff to like focus on. However, I do feel they could have made easily a half hour show from the Edge of Extinction. There was enough action and enough good conversation and humorous moments, catching fish, you know, falling down on the rocks, finding coconuts. Like there was enough information there where you could have, you know, made a decent out of it. I was just an editing choice. But yeah, you know, we are people at its core, and the Edge of Extinction gave us a little bit more time to like converse on a human level than the real game
did. Yeah, absolutely. Do you feel like today's players, and maybe this is part of fueling the longevity of the show, have it so much better than you as one of the original three-season pioneers, where I feel like there's more food challenges, you know, per episode than I've ever seen. Is that necessary to keep the show going?
I don't know. I mean, you know, for me, like I honestly feel I can outstarve anyone on the planet. Like that's a skill set for me. Like my whole strategy was like, let's eat as much food as possible early on, because I'm so much better at starving than everyone else that when we have no food, I'm going to like rise to the top. That was a strategy of mine. So when other people want to ration the food over an extended period of time. So there is a lot more food opportunities. There's a lot more, I guess, chance opportunities, in the sense where, you know, there's a hidden idol, or there's an advantage, or there's fire tokens. Like there are a lot more opportunities to get yourself ahead in the game that weren't around back then. So like you really needed to rely on your own personality traits, your own manipulation, whatever you want to call it, winning challenges and surviving off the land. That's what it was back in the day, in right. The core. And now there's just so many different options. It's just like it's tough to even strategize for the long term. That's why things are like, it's tribal to tribal. Like the game is just a game between tribals, is really what it is. And you know, so I do think they have an easier, like the survival side of it is a lot easier. Like it was a lot easier, but the mental and strategic side of it is a lot more difficult.
Yeah, that's a good way to sum it up.
My experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have, I mean, I could ask you how bad your co-contestants smell, but I'm sure it's awful. But do you have mirrors or razors? I mean, is there any basic, you know, hygiene, outhouse, anything?
Nothing. We get not like no toothbrush, no deodorant, no razors. You know, the only thing you can bring is if you're on, you know, prescription medicine. And if you're wondering, I did ask if I could bring cannabis because they said no. my CBD and cannabis, right? You know, I got to get that in there. But no, the doctor said no to that because it's illegal in Fiji, unfortunately. But yeah, there's a medical box. So they give you sunscreen, they give you bug spray, and then all your prescription meds. And that's it. The rest, you're on your own. You don't get anything. And water. They have a well now that's got water in it.
All right. Most often asked question by members of my family. Won't they know you're searching for an idol if there's a camera crew following you?
Yes, they will. They will. But there are a lot of camera crews. And there are at least 3 camera crews per tribe all day. So if 1 or 2 people are looking for, you know, an idol, they're following you. They're keeping 1 camera back at camp. So if 2 people go off, they're following you. But that was a major dilemma because, yes, it gets to a point where like if one person starts looking, like everyone goes and looks. And also it's also you know, that you can't just go off on your own anymore. Like in Survivor Africa and All Stars, like I could go take a walk down the beach or hang out with a buddy, you know, to shoot the shit. But now you can't, because if you walk off with anyone, oh, they're looking for an idol, or they're an alliance, or they're doing X, Y, and Z. So it's almost like we are paralyzed by the opportunity to go look for an idol. And it became another part of the strategy. Like how and when can you sneak away to look for an idol? Like you're waking up at 4 a.m. when the sun's coming up to go look for an idol. You're saying, oh, I got to go get water. And you're sneaking off looking for an idol here and there. So it's all in the run of show. Or you agree as a group that we're all going to go look for an idol right now.
Right.
But yeah, it's a factor.
What do you, you know, let's give Probst and Company some credit here. How the hell is this show not only still going, but, you know, still innovating, but still drawing ratings? Just to update you on my fandom, I watched seasons 1 through 3 as hardcore as anybody else. Stopped watching. Found out 10 years later, my parents were still watching and taping every episode of every season. I'm like, this show's still on? What? I got back in around season 16 and have been absolutely, or maybe it was 18, whatever. It was absolutely hardcore since then. What's the secret sauce here? Why does this thing still work?
I believe... One, it's a family show. People, you know, it's fun for the whole family to watch. And they do such a good job casting people from all walks of life that I think anyone watching the show can almost insert themselves into it and just kind of like pretend this is what I would have done, or I would have never done that, or I would align with this dude. Or so it's almost like, a voyeuristic experience, because in the end, we're just normal people that got cast and got lucky to be on this show. So it's not like we've trained our whole life to be an actor or an actress or a high performing athlete. And it's fun to watch as a viewer, but you can't imagine yourself in that experience. I think Survivor, you can absolutely, anyone on the planet can imagine what they would do if they were out there on the show and how they would relate to everyone. And I think that's the draw.
Yeah.
And Jeff Probst, they do an incredible job of innovating the show. I really think it's the cross section of it's a little snapshot of what's going on in the world. You know, they bring up sensitive issues. They talk about stuff other shows don't want to talk about. They do charity stuff. They go into the villages. It's geographically exciting. It's visually beautiful. Editing is awesome. Characters are fun. It's just a real, nice family friendly show.
Tell me about this. When you won in 2001, this show has been popular throughout, but I don't think people, if they didn't watch those first couple seasons, realize how ridiculously popular this show, was. I mean, when you win in 2001 Survivor Africa, and you're a young, good looking guy, you got the soccer thing going on the side, you end up doing TV work. What was it like to go from regular guy to essentially a celebrity, like overnight?
It was awesome. people are like, I'm not going to lie, it was a really fun time of my life. Like you said, I was coming off a playing career in the minor league levels in Africa. I was playing in the Zimbabwe Premier League, living in New York City, coaching at D1, Fairleigh Dickinson University. And then I won, and like your life is just blown apart at the seams in a good way. And people start recognizing you, a lot of opportunity. I was single and 27. There was a lot of, women throwing themselves all around. You get into clubs and parties. It's just like, it was insane. And I don't think people realize there was no other reality shows on the air. So it's not like I'm thinking that I'm this big thing. It's just there's no other options for people to watch. So I was right place, right time. I think my finale was 27 million people watched the Survivor Africa finale. Like the premiere of Survivor All-Stars was after the Super Bowl on CBS. The Patriots won. I think it was like 32, 33 million people watching Survivor. Now they're getting 7 to 9 million viewers a week versus 27 to 30 million viewers a week.
Yeah.
So just put that into perspective in the grand scheme of what TV was like back then. So that's why it was just so exciting.
I mean, you were in a spot where you're all over the magazines. You did the Howard Stern show. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention this because of me growing up in the 90s. Did you really date Jennifer Love Hewitt? Did this really happen, Ethan Zahn? Because you could just walk off and retire right now if this is true.
It really did happen. It really did happen. However, it ended quickly because of my experience on Howard Stern, unfortunately, because I wasn't, he's a really good at what he does, and I was unprepared, and we weren't necessarily too public about our dating experience, and he found out and just ripped me apart. And then I had a long talk with Jennifer Love Hewitt after, and it didn't go much further than that.
Oh, come on. Oh, that is, I didn't expect
no,
this.
I don't think that was a reason. She's an incredible woman. She's really nice to meet and hang out with. But we're both young. I mean, I was 27 years old.
That's fantastic. Look, to close here, it wasn't just Survivor. We know you from that. We saw you on season 19 of Amazing Race. If Wikipedia is right, I've also seen you on Fear Factor. I remember that in 2005. You did Kill Reality. I don't remember that. Celebrity Paranormal Project. Right. There was Pitchmen on the Discovery Channel. I remember that time Richard Hatch was on The Apprentice and you were on there. Is there any trip down the reality road that you want to take back?
Oh, no. That was so awesome because there was the opportunity. And I was the type of person who just I realized that I was in a really lucky position and the world was coming at me. And so I literally just said yes to everything. I didn't care because I knew it was going to end. And when it was ending, I'd be fine with that. You get in, you have fun, you maximize it. You use the platform for good if you can. And then when it's over, it's over. And so, yeah, I said yes to all those things. You missed Eco Challenge, which is, makes Survivor and Amazing Race look like, a day at the Disney World, you know?
Yeah.
And that's coming back on the air as well this fall as well. I'm really excited to see Eco Challenge. But yeah, it was, I got really lucky to be able to do all that stuff.
You can almost go full time. We've seen people on like the MTV Challenge circuit do this, where like that's your full time job, reality star. Did that ever cross the mind for you at all?
No, it really didn't. You know, I was open to all of it. I got into hosting, which is something I never thought I'd do. I started broadcasting for soccer and being the sideline reporters and calling games as an analyst. So that was really fun. And it opened doors in the soccer world. So, you know, for me, going on Survivor was always about the game. It was about winning. It was about getting the title. You know, like I'm sure some of your MMA guys are talking about, I just wanted to win the title. That will never go away. The money's going to go. And so that was hugely important for me, is just as a competitor and as an athlete, it's just to win. So I didn't really want to be a reality star. And, you know, I had, you know, I used the money that I won from Survivor Africa. I donated it to start a charity called Grassroots Soccer. And so now we're currently in 60 countries.
Wow.
We've graduated 2.9 million kids from the program. So for me, that's what Survivor did for me. It enabled me to start this charity and kind of really save a lot of lives in this world. And so I always had that as my real passion, and Survivor and the platform it gave me was just a really great vehicle to amplify what we were doing at Grassroots Soccer.
Great stuff. And I've, you know, you were the national ambassador for Stand Up to Cancer. You've inspired a lot of people. So how about you inspire somebody in the CBS family? We know him. We love him. It's David Sampson from the Nothing Personal podcast. He's of course the former president of the Miami Marlins, Montreal Expos. You remember our good friend Samson, 2014 Survivor Cagayan season 28, showed up in a suit, but they voted him out in like the first 5 minutes, it seemed like. Is that the
what
hardest,
were they thinking?
Is that the hardest fall we've ever seen? Can you get in Probst's ear and get this guy back on the show here? You got any advice for Samson here?
I think he has got advice for me, probably. yeah, unfortunate early exit for anyone, but the game is you know, the game is so much up to chance that getting voted out first is a real chance for everyone that goes out there.
Oh, he could have won that. He could have. If only they gave him a shot there. Oh, my gosh. Wow. Ethan Zahn, it's been fantastic talking to you. I'm going to hit you with the hardest question of the show to close, and this is really it. It goes like this.
Yes, my hair is real.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would guess no. No, just kidding. No, it looks real. Looks great. The greatest Survivor player of all time. In my household, we're split between Boston Rob and Tony V, two-time winner. You've always been on these lists of the most beloved, the most influential players. Who's the greatest player of all time?
You know, I'm split with the same as you. I'd like to throw Parvati into the mix as well, as a female, you know, winner. Of all those people, I'd probably have to go with Rob, Boston Rob, just because, you know, he's evolved his game. He's played a lot of different ways. He's won, he's lost. So I think he's got the most experience and he's probably one of the best players ever. But Tony, look at what he did this season. This was a season of all winners. So if you can beat all winners at the game of Survivor, you are worthy of the title. And, so I'm split down the line. Although it did take Boston Rob 4 times to win. It only took me once to win, right? I mean, I'm just saying, like, as the original winner from Boston, you know, I'd like to say I paved the way for Boston Rob to, you know, achieve his celebrity status in the Survivor world.
Well said, sir. Great chatting with you. Where can we find you on social media? Are we going to see this book in print? What's going on here?
I don't know, man. I hope so. Now you sparked my interest. Maybe I'll get something going. But you can find me on Instagram at Ethan Zahn. I got a website, ethanzahn.com. Yeah, and I'll be on another reality show this fall.
Ooh.
Called The Kings of Kush. It's about a 116-acre hemp farm in Plainfield, Vermont.
Whoa.
So everyone can keep tuning in. It should be pretty spectacular.
Fantastic on that. And is the Survivor career over? Or is it never over?
I told Probst to lose my freaking number.
Well,
so,
I think you're like a lot of the boxers and, you know, MMA guys I talk. There's always one more fight left. There's always one more payday left, right?
I don't know. Maybe if they build a 50-foot statue of me, I'll go back out there again. Like they did to Rob.
Shout out to Rob and Sandra on that. Ethan Zahn, it's been a pleasure, sir. Thank you. Keep inspiring the people. We're going to get through this quarantine. We're going to get through everything, all right?
We are. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Take care.
All right, I couldn't have a Survivor Super Show without bringing on one of my favorite, let's just say, rising voices and talents in the sports broadcasting game, my colleague at CBS Sports. You know him from his days atop the game in Major League Baseball as the Florida/Miami Marlins president, but he's David Sampson, host of Nothing Personal with David Sampson, a fantastic podcast and digital show at CBS Sports. David, I'm fired up to talk to you on so many levels, okay? Love being on your show and doing things with you on CBS Sports HQ. Now you're on mine. You, of course, are a Survivor veteran. You got a little bit of a Survivor beard going on right now. Tell the people, if they haven't seen you on camera lately, what the heck's happening here?
So, first of all, love being on your show. You are amazingly talented. I love working with you as well. It's always fun. So when you asked me to be on, I was super excited. I can tell you that I've been growing this beard for about 122 days because when baseball shut down back in March, I said, all right, as part of Nothing Personal, I'm going to start the ML Beard Challenge. I'm not going to shave until there's opening day in baseball, whenever that is. And in the meantime, for the first 100 days, and I knew it would be longer than 100 days, for the first 100 days, I'm going to give away $1,000 to a different charity every single day.
Yeah.
To help people who've been negatively impacted by COVID. So for 77 days, I gave to all the team foundations in baseball and basketball. I gave to each day a different worthy organization to help. So many people are impacted by COVID, not just the athletes. It takes so much to put on a sporting event. So many ancillary people involved who just get impacted negatively. But then on day 77, I think that's around when George Floyd got murdered. And so I switched. I made an adjustment. And for the last 23 days of the 100 days of giving away money to charity, I chose organizations who are focused on education and solving the social unrest and social injustice and systemic racism issues. So 100 days passed, and then the beard challenge continued. The charity part has ended. The 100 organizations were posted, and that's that, and given to. But now the beard, and the thing is, I committed not to trim it either. So you have a beard, and you look really good. You look like you can eat. So I've lost about 13 pounds in quarantine. I need to use a straw because anytime I do anything, there's hair in my mouth. Yeah. It is brutal.
I was going to ask the job hazards, the life hazards that come because people can only hear you right now and not see you. But it's like Santa Claus level. You're getting a full beard going here. And I certainly respect the methods and the means while you're doing this. Are you at the point now where you can't wait? You can't wait to get this thing off? Are we counting down the days?
So let's be clear. I said that I would shave after first pitch opening day. So here's how it works. On July 23rd, I don't know what day you're releasing this, but on July 23rd at 7:08 p.m. Eastern, the first pitch of the MLB season will happen when the Yankees are in Washington to play the Nationals. I will be with Hugo of Heads Up Barbershop, who is the official barber of the Marlins, the best barber in the country for me. He's cut my hair since 2002 when I joined the Marlins. He's opening his shop, and I will be there because at 7:09 p.m., the process starts of getting this beard off. Now, there better not be rain. They don't have a roof in Washington. So if that game gets rained out, I'll have to sit there until 10:08 p.m. when the Giants play the Dodgers. I assume it's not going to rain in L.A. And if they cancel the MLB season, Brian, all I can say is do not cancel it until after one pitch of one game. After that, let the chips fall where they may.
All right. Before we get into Survivor here real quick, I know you're a busy man. I love your transition you've made because we knew you as baseball executive, and I mentioned the Survivor appearance. But your transition to the, you know, broadcasting hot take game has been fun to watch because I know you may actually have FU money, but I feel like even if you didn't, you'd come from a standpoint where you're just not afraid to say what needs to be said. How has this adjustment been to you in really kind of carving out your voice in this space?
So the answer is I was the president of the Marlins, not the owner. So I definitely need to and want to work. I'm not the guy who will ever retire. I knew that I wouldn't because I love working. And I was the type of president throughout my 18 years in baseball where people noticed that I had a tendency to say things that really weren't very presidential or to be honest and straightforward. And some people were offended by that and bothered by that because they feel there's a certain way that you have to act when you are the president of a major sports team. And I remember thinking to myself that I don't want to go down the path that everyone goes down, where they're boring, where they give BS answers to everything, where they're lying all the time. I have the opportunity, once I'm unshackled, which is how I really felt getting out of baseball, I now have the opportunity to tell people really what goes on. Because one of the unique things I noticed is right after Jeter fired me back in October of 17, and I noticed that in the landscape that I had lived with in 18 years, dealing with the media is a big part of your job when you're the president of a team. Most of the people talking don't know what they're talking about. They actually have never run a team. They've actually not dealt with the issues that are real. They don't know the truth. They just have these takes that are fun. They're hot. They're interesting. They get a lot of attention, but they're based on principles that are just not right. So I felt that I couldn't really correct it as much as I wanted to when I was the president of a team. But once I was done, I said, what can I do? Is there a way for me to use my love of media, my love of talking? Can I make money doing this and educate and inform people? And I found a niche, and Nothing Personal has become this niche filler because we're a very honest show. It's 45 minutes, just me every single day. And I sort of explain to people what the hell's really happening. And often people get it wrong. They don't realize that right. When presidents or players or owners or commissioners or people are saying something, that's not what they mean at all. So I've really enjoyed the transformation. I love working with people like you and all the people at CBS. It's been great. Everyone's interesting to me. Everyone's got a story to tell. And I got news for you. I didn't realize how hard your job is until I started doing it. It's hard.
I'm sure your job running the Marlins was hard as well day to day, but I appreciate that. And you're doing a great job. And I remember the great thing about the show Survivor, right? We all love it. I've been a diehard. I did have gaps in my fandom, but I am a, you know, season one, day one guy. And I always feel like the opening episode, you get that snapshot of somebody. They come on the screen and you get to right away kind of claim who you think they are, right? Oh, that's the dumb hot chick. That guy's going to be the villain. That guy's going to be this. That guy's going to be whatever. And we go back to 2014 when your season was filmed, Survivor Cagayan, season 28 in the Philippines. It's brains, brawn, and beauty, three tribes. And day one, you show up wearing the suit coat and I go, the new villain is in town. The new boss, the guy with the business background, cutthroat. This is going to be my guy. And of course, we know what happened. One episode later, your tribe turned on you and all of that. But I mean, kind of take me back to the beginning. How much of a dream was it for you to get there? And how long had you applied to get to this point?
So the story is back in 2000, Survivor started. It was a mid-season replacement on CBS, and I was working for the Expos. And I watched the first ever episode of season one in Olympic Stadium in the owner's suite. Whoa. After a home game. And we stayed and watched the episode. And I knew from that minute I wanted to be on Survivor. I said, how cool would this be? It's the exact antithesis of who I am. I'm a city boy. I can't make fire. I don't like scrounging for food. I like eating when I'm hungry. I can't deal with people who I don't want to deal with. This is perfect for me. And so I watched Survivor year after year, and it was never the right time because we were getting out of Montreal, getting into Florida, then trying to build the ballpark. There just never seemed to be a good time. And I always said I need to be on the show, but I never applied. So in 2010, I had a conversation with casting because I put a video in. And they called, and I had a little flirtation with them. And they said, you're building a stadium. Like, there's no way you can disappear right. for 45 days. It's just not going to happen. I said, I know, but I really want to be on the show. They said, get back to us when you're really ready. So in 2012, after the ballpark was open, Marlins Park, we were having a disastrous season. It was a nightmare with Ozzie Guillen. We couldn't win a game. We had to trade all these players at the end of the season, the famous Toronto Blue Jays trade. It was just horrific. So I said, isn't this a good time to maybe get to an island and stay for 6 or 8 months? It seems possible. So in late 2012, early 2013, I sent a new video into Survivor, and I got a call the next day, And it was the casting guy saying, is it time? Are you ready? I said, I'm ready. Let's go. He said, well, we're going to need a note from your owner that you can disappear. I said, I didn't even tell him I applied. He said, you cannot be on Survivor unless you get a note. I had to go to Jeffrey Loria in the middle of all of the stuff going on with our team. It was a disaster. We're losing money. We had done a fire sale. It was bad. I said, hey, Jeffrey, you've ever heard of the show Survivor? He's like, no. I said, well, it's a reality game show and I want to be on it. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, listen, I'll forego my salary. I'm going to be gone for about 45 days, but I need you to send a letter to Burnett and Probst, the producer and, you know, the host of the show, that I can do this. He was pissed and he finally agreed to do it. I called up the casting guy, said, I got a letter. They immediately had me out to LA for finals casting, where I met Probst, met Burnett. And that was December of 12. And then it filmed in July of 13 and debuted on my birthday, February 26th of 14. And I got voted out first. And I still think about it. I'm telling you right now, this is no BS. I think about it every day.
I was going to ask that question, and I'd have to assume, given your competitiveness, your ability to succeed in various, you know, lanes, business-wise and all that, that, look, nobody wants to be the first in anything negative. And I remember specifically episode one, season one of Survivor, the first lady who, I don't even remember her name, but being like, oh man, she, you know, the popularity of the show, of course, at that point was through the roof. She's going to live with that forever. So I certainly want to get into that in terms of bottling that L that you can really do nothing to fix. But strategy-wise, you had an uphill battle in theory, in my mind, because one, you're a celebrity coming in, so to speak. Two, there's the illusion that because of your celebrity job title that you don't need the money. So in theory, these people would have no intention of helping you get there. And I think in three, you not only have a savviness that comes across in a leadership, but you come on wearing the suit coat. You know, you're out of central casting as that guy, right? The HR boss or the evil owner, or however you want to frame it. Did you have any intentions of, I guess, dumbing down? Because we've discovered over the years that you can't be all alpha and win. You can't be, you have to almost figure out how to be non-threatening and mediocre to survive and wiggle your way through.
It's a great question. So let me start with a few things that will blow your mind. Number one, I had to tell people in my tribe that I was in marketing for the Miami Marlins.
Okay.
Not that I was the president, but I am 99.99999% sure that all of them knew that I was the president of the team. Cliff Robinson was on our season.
Yes.
So I thought he was, quote unquote, the celebrity, quote unquote, for that season. So I thought my story was going to fly. I found out later that it was very clear to everyone. Two people on the Tribe of Six knew immediately, and the other three were then told immediately. So I didn't get away with that lie. And I didn't know that it was brains versus bronze versus beauty until filming started. They don't tell you what the theme of the show is. What they do tell you is what you're wearing. So,
they do. Okay.
So I was given, you know, the Thurston Howell costume. And for those of you who are too young to know, that's from Gilligan's Island. And Google it, for Christ's sake, if you still don't know. And I thought that it would be to my advantage to have a blazer, because I could use it to comfort women when they were cold if it rained. I could use it as a pillow. I wanted to have pants that I could eventually cut to be shorts if I needed. I liked the idea of a long sleeve button down shirt, because I again could cut the sleeves off, or I could have it depending on the weather, because there was no way to know how much rain there'd be, because back then you didn't know that you were filming in the Philippines. Survivor used to change locations all the time. Now it's always in Fiji, and you know when you're going on Survivor, it's going to be in Fiji. Back then it would switch. So we get to the Philippines, and we only know we're going to the Philippines when we go as a group to Los Angeles International Airport, and you go to the check-in, and it's Air Philippines, and you're like, oh, we're going to Manila. Wow. Little did we know that we landed in Manila, took another two-hour plane ride to Luzon, then took another two-hour bus ride to get to the tip-top northern part of the Philippines. In silence, by the way. There's no talking to your other castmates until the cameras roll. Not a word.
Okay, you're showing how the sausage is made by our great company, Viacom CBS here, and I like it. I like that they are doing everything to you know, instill the element of surprise and of like, we don't really know where this is going.
It's great because as a player, you're trying to size people up and you're doing it in silence. You're trying to figure out who's who. And then all of a sudden you get to the start of filming. You see that there's three bribes and you still don't know that it's Brains, Brawn, Beauty. And then Jeff Probst starts talking. And then he says, welcome to Survivor Cagayan. And then he says, what is it that it takes to win? Let's find out. Brains, Brawn, Beauty. And I'm looking around and I see Cliff Robinson. And I say, all right, I'm definitely not the Brawn. Then I look around and I see what had to have been a beauty queen. And it turns out I was right. Her name was Jeffra. Yeah. And another woman named Morgan, just two beautiful women. And I'm all right.
I know we're not allowed to say this, but Morgan might be the most beautiful I've ever seen on Survivor. So shout out to her.
Shout out to her. She's awesome, by the way. Ironically, they're all amazing people. You hate them during the course of filming and then you love them. And many of us are still in touch. Many of us. So then I look and I see Jeffra and Morgan. I say, oh God. And I look at Jatia, who I didn't know her name, but she had a nerd shirt on. And I said, oh my God, this is all going on in my head as filming is starting. I said, oh my God, we're the Brains. This is not good. This is not good. Look at how I'm dressed. All of this is going on. And then Jeff Probst says, and now you each have to choose a leader. And that's it. First rule of Survivor, don't be a leader early. Yes. And they elected me leader. And I tried to get anyone to be leader. And it screwed me. And then I chose Garrett to vote him off the tribe, which turned out to be a mistake. Basically, I had an entire plan going on the show. And I screwed up every part of it. There wasn't one thing that I had planned on doing that I was able to do once the cameras rolled.
Well, look, people have to understand, like, when you cared about this much to be on this show, you performing up to the level you think you could and having a chance to win is everything to you. So this the L's going to bleed whether you think it's your fault or it's circumstance. The only equivalent I could say is my entire youth, I was one of those sports statistics, historical fact nerds. I could outstump anybody. I wanted to be on a game show to test myself against the very best more than anything in my entire life. I'd come home after school, you know, study encyclopedias, study all that stuff, every sport across the board. When I was 22, I get on ESPN's 2-minute drill. I make the cut. I pass the test. I win them over personality-wise. I get on the show. There's season 2 tournament, 32 people. I'm there for my first episode. I know I can beat this guy. I spent 6 hours in the green room with him, and I lost, and I took a hard L. I froze in front of the cameras, got some easy ones wrong. They screwed me in a key moment where Gary Barnett, former coach of Colorado football, asked the question the wrong way. It confused me. They gave it to me a wrong answer when I really got it right. But just to tell that story, I was crying in the green room afterwards because this was still real to me. This was all I ever wanted to do in life was compete at something that I cared about at the super elite level. I couldn't even watch the show. It just killed me. Do you feel in hindsight that it was your fault or that you got caught up in circumstance time? Because look, when Probst put you on the spot, it is what it is. You gotta think right off the top of your head. Does it still irk at you that it should have gone differently and that it might be your fault? How do you feel about that?
So I feel about it sort of like the lyrics to the song by Jimmy Buffett, Margaritaville, where he starts that song at the end of one refrain that it's somebody else's fault. And then the second is it could be my fault. And then the third one is, yeah, it's my fault. Right. So that's sort of the process I went through where immediately after I got voted out, I was in disbelief. I was like, these guys are bastards. They set me up. They wanted me out here to use me for my position and they're going to market it. And then I'm gone after a day. This is ridiculous. I wouldn't acknowledge any of the mistakes I made. And then time passed and I said, you know what? It's definitely a combination. They totally screwed me, but I could have done better. I knew they were screwing me. I should have picked up on that. And now my position is it's 100% my fault. They put me in a position where I had to fight my way out. And if I were as good as I thought I was, I would have fought my way out and I would have made better decisions. So I don't blame them at all. I blame myself. But what you said about remembering it, I've accomplished a lot in my life and I'm proud. I'm 52 years old and I've done athletic achievements and, you know, marathons and Ironman and raised money for charity and won a World Series. And I've done a lot of cool things and I have three kids who were healthy. I mean, just, you know, whatever. Like, I've made plenty of mistakes. I think about Survivor every day. It's insane.
Oh, my God. I hear you. Isn't it weird that it could be a breakup? It could be I lost in the semifinals in high school basketball, and in a rec league, not even high school ball, in a freaking rec league, and I still can get mad thinking about it today. It's crazy in life how we hold on to these things that shouldn't matter, but they do. But it's because it's still real to us. It's because we have this passion. So you end up getting voted out, 3 votes to do, close vote. They blindside you. It probably came down to you having to say Garrett was the weakest player out loud because he held that against you. Do you and Garrett end up having some hot water after that?
Well, Garrett wouldn't talk to me immediately after. He got voted out second. So Garrett had changed his life for a year before going on Survivor. He told me that he was a personal trainer because he had an 8-pack, and he was just, I didn't like Garrett from the minute I didn't meet him, because you see the people in your cast, you're waiting for the plane, you're not talking. This guy's eating everything in sight. And then we get to the island and have pregame where you have to see the doctor and you do some media stuff, you get et cetera, and you prepare for the start of the show. And he spent all day eating. And it made me crazy. And then I find that I'm on the tribe with him, and I just didn't want to be around him. Then he says that he's a personal trainer. I said, how are you on the brains tribe if you're a personal trainer, right? Give me a break. But he said, that's what I am. And it didn't even occur to me that I was lying about what I did for a living. So I knew that he was lying, but it didn't occur to me what he did for a living. I didn't think about it. It turns out he's a professional poker player. So he spent a year preparing to be on Survivor, watched every season. He had a full strategy in place. And when he lost, he took it really hard. And he'll tell you today. So we didn't speak for a bit, but then I reached out and we spoke, and we are friends to this day. Really? We text back and forth. I speak to everyone on the Brains Tribe. We have a group text, the six of us together, Spencer and Cass and Jatia and Tasha and Garrett and I. I speak to other people from that season, whether it's Alexis, Cliff, Uncle Cliffy. You know, you get a bond when you are a part of this experience. One of the things that I've learned through baseball is a lot of people think they have shared the experience with you because they've watched it on TV. But the truth is they haven't shared it at all. They have merely put themselves into the experience by watching it and thinking they know you and know the circumstance. But you end up really clinging to people who have gone through that experience with you, whether it's in a baseball clubhouse or in a Survivor cast when you're on an island, because you can't go home and tell your loved ones what it was like because they don't get it. And you go through this amazingly deep experience physically and emotionally, and you can only share with the people who are there. So that bond is forever. And that's one of the cool things about the Survivor family.
I love that. I also love how you dealt with the being voted out in the moment, right? We always wait to see the face. Will the person be mad? Will they say, you know, well played? You, when you had your sit down on the camera, said, quote, I have no regrets. I played the way I needed to play. The tribe just doesn't have it together. I consider myself the luckiest person in the world, end quote. Little Lou Gehrig there, by the way, okay?
Which
I did a little research. You did attend, tell me if I'm wrong, Horace Mann High School, which was in the neighborhood that the great Lou Gehrig lived during his time post-Yankees. I only know that because my best friend went to Manhattan College, so I partied many down there. But
that's right in the Bronx, right at Van Cortlandt Park.
I parked in front of Horace Mann many a time. I'm sure you're crazy angry in that moment, but you decided to take the high road there. You could have ripped everybody. I respect you for that.
Let me bring you back to how they actually film that, because it's pretty interesting. So tribal council takes a long time. You know, it's not 10 minutes the way it is on the show. It takes a long time and it gets edited. And then when the minute I knew I was done is when the second vote came for me, because it was supposed to be 5-1. That's what we had all agreed to, that we were going against Jatia. And I know Jatia would vote for me and then 5 votes on Jatia. But the minute there's a second vote, I know that I have a problem and that I'm gone. So I'm in the moment. And the first thing I thought of, cameras are rolling. I mean, it's all happening. There's camera people. There's people everywhere. And it was raining and I was hungry and I was miserable. Jeff hasn't read the final vote saying in the first person voted out yet. He's going into the jar, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm the first boot. I am the first boot of Survivor. I cannot believe this is happening. That is where my head was. He calls the name and I'm sitting there. And then the torches, by the way, are really heavy. So I pick up the torch. I put it in the hole in the ground, which they had taught us how to do whenever you're voted out. He snuffs it. I look at him and I was like, you mother. Like, I was so angry. You then walk 20 feet and there are people waiting for you and you go right to film your exit immediately because they want that rawness out of you.
Yes.
And I said, I know what they want from me and I'm not giving it to them. I am not going to take the low road because this will be part of my legacy. As it is, I'm the first boot and it's a nightmare. I am not going to be one of those sourpuss Sallies. I am going to, is that even an expression? I am going to take the high road and I'm going to acknowledge that I got it wrong. Our tribe is an absolute mess, but at the end of the day, it was on me. But after all is said and done,
hey, David,
I am a lucky guy.
That's media savvy right there. That is years of being interviewed by the baseball press and turning words against you and you having a distinct advantage because you could have flipped off Garrett and been like, I'm coming for you in real life, by the way.
Mother, you're exactly
but
right.
You didn't do that. You said during your Ponderosa interview, quote, you can only control the things you control. Can't control. This was very Zen-like, but I want to use that as a transition to say, what did you end up learning about life? Because that's a big theme now in the last 5-10 seasons about, especially with the extra island that sometimes, what do they call it nowadays?
Edge of Extinction, Island of the Idols.
It seems to all be all about, okay, these people probably won't win, but we're going to showcase their personal inner journey. What was your biggest inner journey take? I know you're only there 3 days, more or less, but what did you take away personally from that experience?
Well, I think that I'm asked a lot about Survivor, believe it or not. I'm recognized, believe it or not, as much for Survivor now. It's more nothing personal and people who have listened and watched. But it's interesting. People do love that show. And for whatever reason, there's only 39 people in the world who can say they were the first boot of Survivor in the U.S., right? There's 39 of us. That's it. Francesca got it twice. So there's 39 of us. And it's a special exclusive club. And I've met a few people in the club and we have fun talking about it and it hurts. But what I learned is that I'm a big time control freak, and to be the president of a team, to have your own show, it's my name. And I want to control everything about my show because it's a reflection of my work ethic. And if I'm not prepared, then people will know that. And I always tell people about nothing personal. They don't realize how much preparation it takes to look unprepared. And that is what nothing personal is about, because I don't use a script. I don't use a teleprompter. And what I learned in Survivor is that even when you are in total control in your own mind of all of your surroundings, there are still things that require adjustment in real time. And if you are not willing and able to do real time adjustments, you're going to get left behind. And that was, 6 years ago. And I think about Survivor all the time still. And I think about the lesson I learned, which is control what you can completely and then recognize when it's time to adjust.
I like that. I like that a lot. Be honest here. How often have you reached out since taking that L first episode of the season to get back on, to slay your personal Survivor demons and get on one of these all-star casts or second chances or something?
So if they would do a first boot season, would I take the call? Of course I'd take the call and I would talk about it. I would think about it. I don't know. I mean, it's a difficult question because the thought of being first boot twice would enter my head, obviously. The thought of being away from CBS and nothing personal for that period of time would enter my head. But on the other hand, the chance to accomplish things on the show that I wanted to accomplish that I didn't get to, that's pretty much a theme of mine. I want to win everything I do. I'm incredibly competitive, which is ironic for a 5'5", 130-pound guy. I'm incredibly competitive. I don't want to lose at anything. I was the father who would not let my kids win at any board game or card game. I just wouldn't do it. And I would get yelled at saying, it's okay to let her win. She's 4. I said, no, I won. If she wants to beat me, tell her to get better at the game. And so that level of competitiveness has always been inside me, and it's not going away anytime soon. And so I want to win. I want to win. So if I'm asked to play again, it's going to be hard to say no.
I Love that. I love that. All right, quick lightning round to close here. I could go hours with you. Always entertaining. You were on the season with Tony Vlachos, who not only won your season, he just wins season 40, which, you know, in a lot of ways was the Super Bowl of Super Bowl seasons, bringing back former champions. Big theme on this podcast, talking to Ethan Zahn, talking to my great friend and Survivor historian Eric Raskin, was who's the greatest player of all time? If for my money, it's Tony, or it's maybe Boston Rob. For David Sampson's money, and I know you have watched every season, if that's correct, or if that's incorrect, correct me, who is the greatest player of all time and why?
He who has made the most money is the greatest player. Tony's won $3 million. He is the greatest player. He's tied with Sandra. They've each won it twice. But Tony, you know, he won my season. He won season 40. I love being in touch with him. He's a great guy, a great, great guy. Nothing like he is on the show. He is a family guy who, you know, is a humble, you know, policeman in Jersey. And to me, he is the greatest Survivor player because he advances the story better than any other player. He plays the game better than any other player in a way that's entertaining to the audience. And he finds a way to get people to do what he wants while having them think they're doing what they want.
I love that. I love that. All right. The reason why I still watch Survivor and I came back after a long hiatus was because, David, in the era of reality TV where we can see the strings pulling the puppet on so many shows, we tend to not believe what we're watching, yet we still watch it because it's cheap and easy entertainment. I still feel like Survivor is as real as it can be. Yeah, there's rule changes on the fly for entertainment purposes, but the things you're telling me, the things I perceive, this is as close to a sport as possible. We can do podcasts like this where we rank the greatest because it's a competition and there's a training to get there. There's methods, there's all that. What was something on your short journey there that surprised you that you know, was real or that made it harder or something in that line where you're like, damn, this really is a competition?
So I had practiced with flint and a machete before I went on the island, and I didn't realize how tired and how hungry I would be when the game even first started. And we couldn't make fire. We had no flint. We couldn't find a way to put sticks together. I tried to channel Castaway, ironically, given the way I look right now. Could not rub sticks together to make a fire. And the hunger, the thirst is real. I didn't realize how hard it is to open a coconut. I mean, it's hard. And all the things that you just sort of take for granted that I didn't have to do in my life because I'm so privileged, all of a sudden it's down to the bare necessities. And you need food and you need shelter. Those are two things that matter, and you can't get to the gameplay without those two, and those two are much harder than you think.
How can you put into words what the deprivation, whether it be dehydration, lack of sleep, lack of food, does to the mind? How hard is it to stay strategically sound? Because it's easy to watch the show and be like, what an idiot. Why did he do that? What's it like in it?
Yeah, I don't think people realize that the hunger is real. Now, there's camera people around and producers and sound people, and they get to eat. So, you know, they've got fanny packs and they're eating granola bars. They try to hide it from you, but they're eating because they're working. It's their job. They're not playing Survivor, but the hunger's real. And even though there's some challenges and rewards, you get sick when you know, if you talk to people who've been on reward challenges, food challenges, you know, you get sick. They don't show that on TV, but the sickness and the stomach ache and the upset stomach that you have and the digestive issues because your body's not used to it. When you shove hamburgers or pizza into your mouth after not eating and just eating rice, it's a problem. And so, you know, that part is really on point.
Now, what about what's the worst hygiene element? Because everyone's probably cornered you and asked you 50 questions about what people smell like, where you go in the bathroom. What's the hardest hygiene element when you're in not even third world, you're in barbaric conditions there?
So I was not able to take an aqua dump, and that's the only way you can. You have to go into the ocean. They tell you where you can go to number two, and you're supposed to practice it before the game starts. And I could never sort of ease my abdomen enough to do it. The good news is I had nothing to eat, so I didn't have to go. But I tried during the course of my 3 days in the water and just couldn't ever do it. So that was much harder than I ever expected it to be.
Wow, that is how the sausage is made and delivered right there. In closing, you only had to go 3 days, so I can't ask you what's it like on day 28 when your stomach is eating itself. But if we did a two-man edition of Survivor, Survivor Season 41, titled Grudge Match, two men on an island alone, who lasts longer, David Sampson or Derek Jeter?
Well, it depends. What tools do we have? Does he have any weapons of any kind?
No.
So it's just the two of us trying to survive?
Yes.
You know, it's funny. Derek and I, we worked together when he was trying to buy the team, and he was trying to get me to like him, thinking that would help choose him to be the buyer of the Marlins. I didn't care. I mean, I knew that he was being nice to me only because he thought that that would make me somehow favor his group. I didn't fall for that. It was like a little game of Survivor, is selling the Marlins. That's what that was, getting people to bid against each other, getting people to think that someone else was hating them or someone else was bidding more money. So I'd love to be on an island with Derek and just sit him down and say, hey, not so easy running a team, is it, Derek?
Text that, Derek. All right, indeed. David Sampson, this was a joy to behold. I definitely encourage the listeners to check out what you're doing on Nothing Personal with David Sampson. I mean, it's only business. It's nothing personal, okay? Fantastic work with the beard, the charity, all that stuff. Great chatting with you, my friend.
Thank you so much.
All right, I promised you a Survivor expert. And there's no man, there is no man that I could turn to out of any other, unless Rob Cesternino was available. His name is Eric Raskin. He's a beloved boxing journalist, the co-host of the Showtime Boxing Podcast with Raskin and Mulvaney, and the author, yes, of poker.
The Moneymaker Effect?
The Moneymaker Effect. Yeah. Yes, how poking changed the world. It is Eric Raskin, King of Prussia's finest. Rask, you and I for a long time have been trading unnecessarily long Survivor emails, breaking down crazy episodes, pitching ideas for podcasts. Well, we failed in all those attempts, but we made it right now, Rask, so thank you for joining me.
And thank you, Brian, for I believe you are the person who woke me up to the fact that Rob Cesternino has a podcast, which I want to say it was like 2013, maybe, that you mentioned to me that he has this podcast. I think he had just had your buddy Coach Benjamin Wade on at the time.
Yes.
I checked out that episode. I've been hooked ever since. I am a Survivor super fan. Expert is maybe questionable, but I've seen every episode. I love the show. And I listen to multiple podcasts every week from the Rob Cesternino Network. So I am all about Survivor, and I'm fired up to talk with you about it.
Well, that's a good reference there on Rob, because, you know, he's created a cottage industry around the idea of taking reality shows and kind of making them like sports, Rask. And if you look at Survivor's history, 40 seasons and the longevity, I mean, you now can do things like what we're going to do today, rank the best players, look at this as a sporting competition. And shout out to those guys for doing it. They have, I don't listen to Rob anymore, but I could, because he's got every person on after they get voted off. I mean, they cover that well. So I'm pumped up and excited. Of course, people know you as a SOC regular. You know, you had great appearances on the Cobra Kai review show, the great Marked for Death one. Yeah, Blood Clot. Shout out to you, everyone, on that one. Rask, let's start at the beginning here. I've laid out my fandom in the past. Watched the first three seasons under heavy doses of all right, those were the days back then. Stopped watching. Found out, like I mentioned a lot, that my parents, you know, about 10 years later, I'm like, wait, this show's still on and you guys still watch it? They're like, we VHS every episode. I'm like, what? I got back in around, remember that one with Colby the Texan? Maybe it was like season 20-ish, right?
When he came back for what would have been, I guess, his third appearance, was that Heroes versus Villains? Is that the season you're talking about?
I believe that was the one right around there. If not, I believe it may have been a couple seasons before that. Maybe it was the Survivor Tonkatins. Maybe it was that one.
Tonkatins!
Yeah, however you want to go there, Probes. But the point is, I've been diehard since then. So if that was the show that got me back in, that's, season 18, 2009, so the last decade. But I do have a gap, as we talked about right there. From season 4 through about 18, I only know the flashbacks that they've shown. Tell the people your Survivor history.
All right, sad to say, I'm basically your parents in this scenario. I'm that guy who my wife would basically say to me, like, how can you still be watching this show? Nobody watches this show anymore. When in fact, it was still always getting 10 million viewers every week, even at its lower points. But yeah, so I the only episodes I did not watch as they aired was the first half of the first season. When it was becoming a phenomenon, I was like, yeah, whatever. It doesn't seem like it's for me. Around the middle of the first season, I started watching. I think maybe the Jervis Boot episode.
Yes.
And then I thought it was fine, whatever. It was the second season, the Australian Outback, when I really was like, whoa, this show's phenomenal. I'm a super fan. And I went back eventually and watched the first half of the first season. But ever since then, I have seen every episode, never missed one. And starting with season 29, I believe it was, my kids started watching with
me.
My son was only like 4 and a half at the time. So basically he was into the challenges and didn't know what the hell was going on otherwise. But now, my kids watch with me every week, and my wife still thinks it's stupid.
All right. Well, my wife was a little slow in allowing the kids in because of the constant underwear modeling by the increasingly skinny women as the episodes went on. And you and I, you know, we've had a couple after hours discussions about that same actual topic. About sometimes you're left, you know, who am I left to look at here and cheer for? That's another topic. But my kids also in their 12-year-old twins. They are diehard suddenly a couple seasons in. Here's the actual response when your wife put you on the spot. You still watch this crap?
I like you. I like sex. It's nice.
Yeah, very nice. Very nice. Enjoy that.
Unfortunately, watching Survivor and getting to take part in sex do not necessarily go together.
Well, they do on a solo level if you're not. Just kidding. That's so gross. Just kidding. All right. So, Rask, we look at this as a sport, man. It's crazy. It's even though I do believe, and I give Jeff Probst, the executive producer and host, and all of them credit for the evolution of this show, even though I do believe there's manipulation within the season, right, to drop in rules at a certain time to kind of create drama, I believe of all the reality shows of its kind that it's the most that's still pretty pure as a competition. You know, they don't tend to, if they want somebody to win, they don't go out of their way to make them win. They do sometimes, like I mentioned, swerve a little to create scenarios, but look, reality TV is rarely ever real. I think this is as close as it gets, correct?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there definitely is some manipulation, and I think some people will point to there's a current streak of, I think, maybe the last 6 winners in a row have all been men, something like that, that maybe there's something a little fundamentally wrong with the direction the game is going in that regard. But it is... it's interesting that you talk about comparing it to a sport, because I think we really felt that more profoundly this spring than ever before when there were no sports and Survivor, the Winners at War season with all the All-Stars coming back, all the champions coming back, seemed to absorb some of the attention that people normally would have been giving to sports. It sort of felt like one of America's prime sports for a couple months there. So there is that element to it. It is legitimately competitive. Like, that's, I think, the number one thing that I watch for is the strategy and the competition and the way these people fight to win. And this is like why I am not a fan of The Amazing Race, for example. That, like, I know some people love that show. My wife actually likes that show more because it's got a lot of travel elements and all. Competitively, it sucks. These teams, like, they go on all these hunts, all these missions, they do all this stuff, and then they all just catch up to each other at the airport, and they're all tied again. Yeah, and it happens every week, and after a couple seasons, I was like, I can't watch this crap.
Is it an elimination episode? I don't know. Let's see who wins first, and then we'll decide. You know, it's like,
right, exactly. So that is less like a pure sport. Survivor, within the reality realm, sure. It's fairly close to a legit competition, I'd say.
All right. People need to remember, and something that came up in the Ethan Zahn interview that the listeners just heard. You have not heard that at this point. We need to remember at least the first 3 seasons, what an absolute phenomenon it was. When I asked Ethan about, you know, essentially becoming a celebrity and going on to date Jennifer Love Hewitt for a short period, 33 million people watched his finale of season 3 when he won.
Wow.
You know, the same amount when he came back in 2004 for the debut episode right after the Super Bowl, after the Patriots won it. Just to put into perspective, I mean, season 1 and even 2, I mean, it was so must-see TV that it was like, get your closest friends, get to their apartment, get a case of Bush heavy, you know, add some other party favors in there and let's get down to business. I remember buying the People magazine after season 1. That was almost like a yearbook of that season. It's that's crazy. But what's even crazier, Rask, is what we started the show talking, that it's evolved to the point where 10, 15 years later, I didn't even know it was still a show. And I was like, what? This is still happening? How is this not on my radar? Oh, and it's still really good. Let me kick it off to you. How has this show been able to maintain where, yeah, they're not doing $33 million in an episode, but they're on CBS, which gets big-time ratings, and you and I are nerds that still care about it.
Yeah, they settled into their core fan base of somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 million or so people who were just, all in and on board for the ride wherever it was going at a certain point. And it does feel like they've started to maybe build the fan base back up, tap into a new generation a little bit. But yeah, it is about the evolution and the adjustments. I think there are purists who will look back at those first couple of seasons when there weren't big twists and big rule changes and say that was like the best version of Survivor and they've tinkered with it too much now. But the fact is, you have to tinker. You have to keep innovating. This show's not going to last 20 years and 40 seasons if you just keep rolling out the show that you rolled out for the first two or three seasons when Ethan Zahn was playing. Like, you know, the game moves so much faster now. And I think I heard Ethan talk about that in some interviews that he was doing shortly after his season, this latest season ended. He was like the prototype for how you play the game perfectly in the earliest seasons. He was basically, be the assistant captain, not the captain, do well, but not too well, be likable, be part of the majority alliance. Somewhere along the line, the show, you still had to do all those things, but you also had to build a resume. And so that added this layer to it where you can't be totally under the radar. You can go under the radar in spots, as Tony Vlachos proved this last season. He started out trying to be under the radar just so he could get deep into the game. But you can't play a whole game under the radar and have a chance at winning the way you could back in the early seasons, or in the middle season specifically. If you got to the end against Russell Hance, you could beat him just by doing nothing and getting to the end and everybody hates him. But yeah, I mean, there are certain, I give the Survivor creators and Probst and whoever else is in on it so much credit for constantly tinkering with it to keep it fresh. A lot of stuff works, a lot of stuff doesn't work at all, but they're constantly trying, and you can just see like the gameplay evolving along the way. There's an interesting thought experiment of just like how important Richard Hatch, that first season, inventing alliances, basically, that I guess it was 16 players, 15 of them probably showed up thinking they're just playing an individual game. And had Hatch not been there, you know, what does Survivor look like after 2 years or 5 years or 10 years, or does it last anywhere near that long? If he doesn't form an alliance and it just instead it's this every person for themselves game. It's a fascinating thought experiment of how he completely changed what I think they had in mind for the show.
And if he doesn't show his wang and his
well, it was Blerkle. It was Blerkle.
Well, you know, Survivor was ahead of the game on being woke, and I think that's a big part of it too. It's not, you know, Ethan nailed it earlier when he said it's the ability to make it welcoming for families that you're creating essentially second and third generation fans. That's a big part. I mean, he talked about the edge of extinction element that's been added into recent episodes as that's almost drastic. If you look at it, a separate part of the main episode where the main part of the episode is we're competing for this money prize. But this edge of extinction side of it is all about the personal journey. So they've made it in some ways less about survival, because it really hasn't been about survival in a long time. You know, people right. that didn't watch in the beginning, not just was it the fact that, like you mentioned, you could go a whole season with one blindside. You've been waiting 10 weeks to finally get a blindside. Like, that was the moment. Now you got four blindsides an episode, but you're also not like, oh my God, can they physically do this? Like, that rarely comes up anymore unless there's extreme heat or an injury or something like that. So that has helped get it away from like shock value, naked and afraid television and more into what it's now. It's now a very woke show in good ways. It's now a very inspirational show. It's now a lot of different things at one. That's a key part of the longevity. Obviously, right now, this month, this week, we couldn't pick a better time, Ras, to have these type of discussions, because they just wrapped season 40 in May was the finale. You mentioned it, Winners at War. This is the ultimate all-star game. We've seen all-star seasons in the past, but this season was essentially aimed at, let's legitimately grab who we believe close enough to be our best players. It's not all the best, right? There were a couple recency bias ones that you throw in there to keep the newer viewers. And I'm sure you can't get everybody, but this is the closest it came to the idea of legitimately crowning the GOAT, you know, the best of all time. So good timing in that regard. And, you know, shout out to them again for constantly tweaking this and making it something worthwhile. It seems like Survivor meant different things to different people at different points. Yeah, it's always been the Rask. This guy Probst must have a couple mansions. Must be, you know, he's all right. I feel like if we got to know that guy, we'd be disappointed.
That's a good question. Would I like Jeff Probst if I hung out with Jeff Probst? I don't know, but that, you know, you set me up for my for easily my best Survivor that I've met story. I'll tell you a guy I'm hitting you early. I could have saved this for the end, but a guy that. People might think not knowing him in real life the way I do. And knowing him in real life, I mean, I met him twice for like 3 minutes apiece, but still good guy that you might not believe it. Boston Rob. I'm telling you the circumstances that I met him. 2005 World Series of Poker main event. I'm out there as a journalist. I'm out on the floor and I see Amber Berkich, not yet married. Yes. I don't believe. I think they were engaged at the time. I see her like standing among the crowd, kind of watching. So I follow her line of vision. I'm trying to like see where she's looking. And I see a few tables into the field. There's Rob Mariano playing in the World Series main event. I wait for a break when they all get up to go to the bathroom. And I grab him, do a quick interview with him. Super nice guy. I get his address so I can send him the magazine when it's done.
And stalk him.
Brian, what's that?
And maybe stalk him and get pictures of his wife. I see where you're going with this.
No stalking. But so I sent it. So we did a quick interview. Nice guy. Send him the magazine. And how many times in your career, Brian, have you done a piece on somebody or whatever, and they like send you a personalized thank you note? It probably has happened to you like... I was going to say, you can count him on one hand for sure.
I mean, the guy, though, was Mike Tyson. He left me a voicemail. It's the greatest story ever. But yes, one time, Wyclef, that's happened. Yes.
Yeah, it so rarely happens. In this case, Boston Rob sent to our office a personal handwritten thank you note. He loved the issue. He's going to keep buying the magazine. Thanks so much for sending it to him. Blah, blah, blah. Signed, Boston Rob. So good dude,
wow.
Boston Rob.
Shout out to that. I have one story outside of interviewing Ethan Zahn and outside of working with David Sampson, former Marlins president who was voted off in the first episode in 2014. Rask, I went to the 2002 NBA draft at the theater at Madison Square Garden. And this reminds you, you know, the one thing in Survivor that reminds you how quickly we've evolved and woke as a society was that time they had that old guy from season one, Rudy, interviewed in the crowd a couple years back, right? He was in his 80s by that point, and he made in a 1 minute interview like seven different inappropriate comments about the gays and about all that stuff. But just to let you know on that level, 2002 NBA draft. If you remember, Rass, that's the Yao Ming year.
Okay.
Amari Stoudemire, Mike Dunleavy, a couple others like that. I go with my cousin. We wait all day outside to wait in line for the free tickets. We're in the crowd. I'm drunk as a skunk. And just to show you how inappropriate those times were, when Yao Ming gets announced as the first pick and they're showing him on video live in China with his parents, and it's this great cultural moment, we're yelling, USA, go away, like, go back, you know, like, what are we doing? Why?
Oh, no, don't admit this, Brian.
Why are
Come
we
on.
Doing that? Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, a couple minutes later, I turn the corner to head to the bathroom, and I see Jervis Peterson?
Yeah, that's right. From Philly.
From Philly, season one. Like you know, good guy, all that. I go, Jervis! He's like, hey, what's up? He turns around and I'm basically, if you listen to the boxing podcast, I'm campioning Jervis Peterson.
Nice.
Only I'm not here to pluff his bag. I go, hey, Jervis, that 15 minutes up yet? And I look at my watch and start tapping it. And he gave me the saddest look, like, oh, come on. And I feel I regret that in hindsight.
I wish I could go back in time to that moment and turn to Jervis and say, hey, don't worry, buddy. You're going to be back in a blood versus water season about 10 years from now. Your 15 minutes still has 30 seconds left.
A couple more minutes left in there. All right. We love us some Survivor. I don't know. You know, I don't really plan stuff out, Ras. So let's just wing it. Let's just balls wing it here. There is this idea of treating this like a sport. And if season 40 with Tony Vlachos winning the Cops Are Us, all that, winning a second time, it did bring up the conversation that I like having here. The idea of who is the greatest Survivor player of all time. Now, to get there, though, I want to ask some fundamental questions about winning Survivor, stuff that you sort of teased in the beginning. Most times, Rask, it's three people going to the final vote. It's America voting. I'm sorry. It's not America voting. It's the jury.
Let me get it right.
It's the jury. So it does create that interesting dynamic where everyone that you potentially piss off and eliminate, you have to find a way to show them that you did it for the game. I still do. What's the word? I still do find it interesting, Ras, that we're 40 seasons into this and people still take blindsides so damn personally. Now I have to, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt and say they're not watching the season for multiple camera reviews with the confessional interviews. They're in their own paranoid, under-eaten state. You know, emotions come out. But there's times when people don't realize that the game is the game, to quote The Wire. Like, it is. Like, you can't win most times without doing some dirt, without cutting people's throats. So that's interesting. But if three people make the finals, you normally have a GOAT, somebody that's easy, somebody that you drag there that can't win. They're only there because they did nothing all year.
Right.
You tend to have a alpha one of the two people who have a chance, somebody that was more aggressive, won more challenges. But you know what I hate the most, Rask? When the B-side wins only because they were likable. And there are many moments in that, including recently, where, you know, when they brought back at season 40 winners and Michelle Fitzgerald comes back, for example, mm-hmm. I'm like, she won? What? And then you go back and you look, you're like, oh, I hated that season, you know? And I go back to, and I don't mean to bring up multiple times when it was females, but there were a few of those in recent years where a female won. You're like, they didn't deserve it. They didn't get it. So this is my long-winded way to ask you, Eric Raskin, is this game set up where not only does mediocrity give you a better chance to win, but the whole point is to like lower your value the whole season so that you have this chance at the end. Am I right or wrong on that?
You're partially right. This is like something that I have debated in my mind many times when the handful of times over 40 seasons, I'm going to say there are maybe three or four times where to the viewing audience, it seemed like they gave it to the wrong person at the end. Now, there are countless times that the person who was playing the best game got eliminated at like final four or final three back when they only had a final two, where you were just playing too well. And if you didn't win that final immunity, clearly they had to take you out. But I'm just talking about the final vote. There have been a handful of times where it felt to us as viewers like they got it wrong. Sometimes that's maybe the edit. Sometimes it's the bitter jury or something to that effect. But there's this question that I've had in my mind that I don't really know if there's a clear answer, but I sort of lean toward whoever wins always deserves it, because that's how the game is set up, is that this jury of your peers is voting and working the jury is part of it. And the jury's opinion of who deserved to win can't be wrong. There's no wrong opinion. It's who did the better job of getting to the final against the opponent with the jury, that everything was pointed towards the jury giving them the votes. I think luck is a huge part of it. And this, I can tie in my poker background with this, that Survivor is a game of a lot of skill, being decent at challenges, being good around camp, building social relationships, playing the strategy smart, all those things. But there's always so much luck thrown in. You get the tribes reshuffle the wrong way for you, and suddenly you're on the wrong side of the numbers. You get, I always go back to that first Russell Hantz season. Was this when you were watching? Had you come back to the show in time for the first Russell Hantz season or not?
No,
I can't quite tell your timing.
I saw his second season. I'm trying to figure out the actual year I came back. When Parvati won at season 16, Micronesia, I was not watching.
Oh, no. It's one of the greatest seasons ever.
It was potentially Survivor Samoa or the Tonkin.
Samoa is the first Russell season.
Is that the first one? Okay, then I did see it. Yes, okay.
Okay, So he came from out of nowhere.
I'm going to pause you and tell you. I just figured out exactly when I came back. Two seasons after that, Survivor Nicaragua, Chase Rice was that Texan guy I was talking about. He came in second. Fabio Judd Berza won that. That was my comeback. Okay, keep going.
So wait, so that's before Samoa or after
it's
Samoa?
The season, it's two seasons after Samoa. So
so you did not watch Samoa?
I did not watch Heroes Villains.
Oh no, BC, no Heroes versus Villains. So, come on, classic.
I have historic holes that you will fill today, Raz.
So I'm going to give you the one sentence description of what happened in Samoa. Is Russell is the ultimate heel, the ultimate villain, but the ultimate like mastermind. He is running the whole game. He was the first player ever to find idols without clues. He started this whole trend that now exists constantly. If you go and you look for idols, before that you needed clues which would point you towards where the idols were. Russell shows up and says, I know that they usually hide the idols under a rock or under a bridge or tucked in a tree or whatever. And he just started looking for them on his own and found all these idols, was running the whole game, was just a complete D-bag a-hole to everybody. Nobody liked him. And he gets to the final against this 22-year-old blonde girl named Natalie White, who had done nothing that we had seen all season. She just coasted along. She was the ultimate goat. Russell had it all figured out. He got to the final against his goat. This was going to be an easy win, and the jury voted against him because they hated him. And so it seemed to the viewer like, oh my God, they totally screwed this up. This jury sucks. But you can say that's the way the game is built. If you can't make the jury like you enough to give you that vote at the end, or at least convince them that they should be voting for you because of how well you played the game and put aside their dislike for you, which a lot of finalists have successfully done that. They get to the final, they know everyone hates them, and they put up a compelling argument that you need to vote for me. Russell didn't do that. So you could say, no, the jury didn't get it wrong. Russell played a 99% perfect game, and the 1% that he screwed up on the social game was so bad that he deserved to lose. So it's this constant debate. But the Michelle Fitzgerald example is another perfect one. Aubrey deserved to beat her in the eyes of us, the viewing audience. Yes. For whatever reason out there in the game, Aubrey came up a little short of convincing the jurists of what she played a little too under the radar. We saw her running the show. They didn't realize she was running the show. So it's fascinating.
I'm glad you brought up season 19, in which Russell deserved it. The goat Natalie White wins it, because I believe season 23 was one of the more heartbreaking ones for me, being a big Benjamin Coach Wade fan. He had that one decision at the end that decided his future. He made the wrong decision on who to keep, and Sophie Clark got a victory. Even though Sophie Clark's a good player, not a great player in my eyes, she got the victory I didn't think she deserved because Coach screwed up. There are other times like the Michelle Fitzgerald where it's just like, what is happening here? So what percentage of this then, when it comes down to winning it, is luck in your eyes?
I think it's become increasingly about luck as it's gone along. Like, you look at those first three seasons or whatever. Yeah, there's always going to be some luck, who you're matched up with on your tribe and stuff like that you can't control. But for the most part, those early seasons, There weren't these twists that were going to completely throw you off your game, and there weren't all these idols and the randomness of, like, you think of a few seasons ago, Cherie Fields gets to the final six. Every single person in the final six has some kind of immunity advantage, and she gets eliminated from the game just because every single other person had some sort of protection. And so even though nobody was ready to vote her out, she goes home. So, I mean, that's like the ultimate case of bad luck. The more twists that there are in the game, the more that luck plays into it, the more they shake up the tribes and put you on a new tribe two or three different times. I'm going to say, what percentage is luck? I don't know, something like a fairly high percentage, like 30%. You know, if you're comparing it to other sports, that's a pretty high percentage. Probably something like 30% of just you need the breaks to go your way. And then the 70% or so is just having that skill set and knowing how to balance the social game, the strategy, the physical game, all that stuff.
Russ, do you look back and see any particular season or moment that was some of these turning points we talk about, where it no longer was the idea of, let me build my tribe, Let me brainwash and fear and build fear in them to stay with me. And then let me pick them apart and try to pull off, you know, when Boston Rob won in such a brilliant manner the most recent time, I believe that was Survivor 22 Redemption Island. I feel like that's the last time you could even do that way. It was like an old school way of winning in a modern time. Is there any kind of turning points that stick out to you where it's like the forever now the game will be played this way? I feel like there were a couple steroid seasons, I call them, where every single week we're trying to blindside people, and now it's just become part of the fabric.
Right. So I guess, you know, the first turning point in a sense would be that Ethan Zahn's season in Africa was the first time that you have your two tribes and they're all figuring out their plans for how they're going to get to the merge. And then they did like a tribe swap that nobody knew they were allowed to do. And it completely shifted the game. That was, I say, the first one. I think the Russell Hantz season, the first time that he changed the game in a lot of ways, also just like reignited interest in the show at a critical point when I think it was flagging. He came along at the perfect time for that. But I'm going to say, you know, that since then, I feel like the first Tony Vlachos season 28, was it Cagayan? He played this game in a way that shouldn't have been able to win. He made a lot of mistakes. He played it so big and so bold and took such chances and was blindsiding people two eliminations before anyone was thinking it was the right time to start blindsiding people. He was making all these moves and he would screw up and piss people off and figure out a way to get those people back on his side. And he sort of created this idea that after that, it felt like the big move era began. Like you had to make big moves. You had to build a resume. You had to have a couple of things that when you got to the end, you could point at and say, I engineered your blindside, your ouster, and I'm not going to apologize for it because I outplayed you. Those sort of things. There was some of that existed in Survivor prior to Tony, but he took it to this new level where I feel like almost every season since then, players have played very consciously thinking about, even if they can't quite follow the Tony blueprint, there have to be various layers to their game. It can't just be like the Boston Rob season that he won, where it's, I am going to just mind control everyone, get the numbers and dominate in that way. Kim Spradlin, when she won, that was somewhere right around the same era as when Boston Rob won, totally dominant performance just by controlling everyone with the social and strategic game. You just can't do that anymore. There are too many twists to the game, too many idols and landmines that are going to go off. You have to be willing to start with one strategy, adjust, readjust. And we saw that from Tony this last season, the way that he made all these adjustments and was able to somehow win again playing his crazy style.
So that's a great setup to now the debate of who's the greatest. And that because people have played multiple times, it's added the idea of having multiple seasons or performances. So you can judge somebody who's only played once or twice, but was dominant against somebody who's played four or five times and has had not only, high finishes or memorable moments, but have become such parts of the fabric of the show that weighs into the idea of being a GOAT as well. So I'm going to put Eric Raskin on the spot. You have a greater grasp of history, although I, of course, will share my opinions within this debate. Can you, Eric Raskin, count down from 5-1 after spending much of your off time, pausing your fatherhood and marriage to do this for the people here? 5-1, the greatest players 40 seasons in on Survivor.
All right. I put a list together before we started. Two names.
Here comes number five. Okay, no more creepy sound effects. Go for it. Yes.
So I have two names that just missed. I basically had like seven I was considering. Do you want to know at the top who my sort of unofficial runners-up were? Or
no,
should I just
no.
hit those at the end because that'll give away too much at the beginning?
Suspense. We need suspense on that.
All right. So we'll get to those later. So number five, I actually was kind of looking for an excuse not to put this person in my top five. I really wanted to, and I just couldn't. I felt like I had to put her in the top five, and it's Sandra Diaz-Twine, the first two-time winner. Maybe I have her too low in the opinion of some people who would put her like top three, but man, she this last season the way that she screwed herself. So she made such a misplay with that idol with Denise. That was bad. I know you want to interrupt me. Okay, fine. Go ahead, BC.
It was her last two seasons were victory laps. They were just like celebrity appearances. They built a statue for her. You cannot count this against what the queen has built, Rask. Okay.
Okay. So then let me poke a little hole in the two seasons that she won. And she is a great player. She absolutely is. Probably prior to this season, I would have had her more like number three or so. But her first season that she won was a classic case of her strategy fits with what her strengths are, which is she's never going to do well in challenges. She has to play the social game and the strategic game only. Basically, she sits out of every challenge now. But
she's the DH of Survivor. Come on.
Right. Exactly. So she. The first season, she got to the end and was kind of lucky to be up against a total goat in the finals, while the bigger characters of the season, like Johnny Fairplay and Rupert, had fallen by the wayside shortly before the end. She played a good game, but it wasn't like one of those seasons where, based on that single win, you would say she was an all-time great player. She seemed like a mediocre winner relative to others after the first one. And the second one, she played another outstanding game in Heroes versus Villains against an unbelievably stacked cast, but I didn't think she deserved to win. I thought Parvati deserved to win that season, but because Parvati had won a couple seasons before, I think that's the main reason the jury leaned towards Sandra. She has two wins. Neither win on its own is an A-plus kind of win. She's my number five. Great player, but a lot of holes in her game, and she I thought her third time back, she did pretty well. Given that she had a huge target on her, she played smart and lasted as long as she could. This last time out, I thought she stunk.
She did stink, and she gave up in this last time out. Thank you for putting her on your top five, because we would have had major issues if you didn't. I do think you can argue her as high as two. I do think there needs to be a line where she can't be the greatest of all time for some of the reasons that you said. But not only is she an icon, not only was she able to win twice, which I don't care how you get there, you win twice, that's pretty crazy. And to do it as a complete non-physical threat, and Rask, I will add this, to do it as essentially a villain who, like, look, we love villains. I want to, you know, count down and later in the show some memorable villains, but it's hard to win as a villain. And she does it with intimidation and has success in this way. And I think when she was a quote unquote coach that year with Rob a couple seasons ago, that's a big moment in a way. That's like putting you in the Hall of Fame. So to not be in the top five would have been a crime. I can see the areas where she's overrated, but I look at it more as not overrated. She's a somewhat limited player who takes what she has and makes those elements so strong and delivers like gangster type quotes.
That's what you get for plotting against me.
Good job.
That's what you get, and the queen stays queen.
The queen stays queen is a line that I yell almost every episode at some point to where my wife and kids are just like, shut up. Like, to me, Rask, and I know Susan Hawk's speech, like, to me, you want to talk about iconic, like, moments or phrases that come up a lot outside of all the tired ones that Probst says every single time in the same places, which are part of the game's fabric. Sandra's the goods. I mean, it's hard to do it with intimidation, and she does it. So shout out to her at number five. I would personally, with my somewhat limited knowledge, probably have her at three, but let's keep going.
I think you could, at this point, you could make a case for as high as four. I can't put her higher than that. But like I said, I had I was looking for excuses not to put her in the top five, and I couldn't do it. I ultimately couldn't do it. So, all right. Number four. This is someone who played the closest thing we've ever seen, perhaps, to a perfect game. But her stock may have dropped a little bit this last season, and it's Kim Spradlin.
Yes.
For a first appearance on the show, she was as dominant as anyone has ever been. I think some people will say that she got the benefit of being up against a weak cast, a weak group of opponents first season. That's possible. But I think this time out, even though she didn't go all the way in Winners at War, she went deep enough without being in control of the game to prove that she had some layers and some dimensions. But it's mostly, this is about how dominant Kim Spradlin was the first time she played. She just had every single player wrapped around her finger and never made a misstep, and is just so great at the kind of game that she plays.
I recognize everything you said about her one season. We will count down what we think is the greatest performance in a single season. She's obviously in that. I don't think she can be in the top five for what I know, because that second appearance was not only underwhelming, she did show some things, but I felt like she was almost not trying to win on the same level. She was sort of like, well, this is an all-star game. We'll see what happens. It's going to be hard to win the $2 million. We'll do what I got to do, whatever. Where I almost feel like, Rass, she could have benefited, and could it have been hard to put her in a top five with one appearance and one win? It's an argument. But I think she could have benefited from a Kurt Cobain-like exit. No, I'm not saying shoot yourself, but I'm saying, Raz, you and I both understand that Nirvana is a hell of a band. Yes, they were part of a shift musically, but they have been given sainthood on a level that I don't always believe they deserve just because they checked out early. They didn't check out early who's the guy who had Jeff Buckley, you know, that type of stuff. Like, guys with one album and they die and you're like, well, they would have been great. I mean, Nirvana gave us something to deal with, but I feel right. Like if she only gave us that first season, we would have more of a legendary air to her. She was the bitter, angry, divorced woman and she brought it, but, she won't be in my top five, but I certainly respect the game. And did she get like hotter between the two seasons?
That's debatable. I would say she maintained her status as a reasonable piece of eye candy, as the top-notch pieces of eye candy get eliminated early, as they always do.
Bonsai to that.
Bonsai, BC.
Bonsai, yes.
No, but you're absolutely the Nirvana parallel is accurate. Had she never played a second time, I think I'd have a better case for her ranked as high as I do here. But I still think that season was just spectacular. And it's tough to come back the second time. Look at what happened to Tony his second time out. It was a disaster. So maybe I don't think she'll ever play a third time, but if she did, maybe we'd see some new level. Anyway, I'm comfortable with her at number four.
Thank you.
Should I move on to number three?
Please do.
All right. Now we get to what I think the top three are. There's a line between the top three and everyone below them. I could not put Sandra Diaz in my top three at this point. My number three, the guy I met in person and sent me a nice note, Boston Rob. Just he's done it so many times. His first season, okay, he was kind of the stoner guy who like had some thoughts but couldn't play a complete game. By the second time back, All-Stars, that's one of your classic, did they give it to the wrong person? He probably deserved to win when they gave it to his soon-to-be wife, Amber, instead on Survivor All-Stars.
Smart move by him allowing that to happen if he had any allowance in that. You know?
Yeah. No, I mean, he wins either way. But, yeah, so then he came back and it was heroes versus villains. He didn't do so great, but then he comes back a fourth time and plays. If there's a season that's on par with Kim Spradlin in terms of dominance for a single season, it's Boston Rob winning. What was that season called? Redemption Island, something like that. I don't know. Redemption Island, maybe.
It was called Redemption Island. It was season 22. Yes.
Yeah. So he was just so dominant. And I think you saw in that recent season that he and Sandra were the coaches. Rob did almost all of the talking. And you could see how his mind is just like built for this game. And he knows every angle. The scene in the first episode of Winners at War, where he is just mind effing Ben Driebergen out on the beach into telling him exactly what he wants him to tell him. And Ben is like panicking. Boston Rob plays it at another level. He's always got a huge target on his back. And he has now he's played five times and he's gone out pre-merge, I guess, three out of five. So that's why I have him at three and not at two or one. But he's just a great player. He really, there's no significant weakness in his game other than maybe he doesn't always do the best job of making people like him along the way.
I think three is the lowest you can have him. I think he is the first one that we've talked about that is in the number one discussion. If you have him at number one, I will not say anything wrong about that. And the main reason, Rask, is because he combines the two elements of the game at the highest level, higher than anyone else, meaning great player and most like beloved icon if he's on the season, I'm going to watch it type of thing, right? You put those together at that highest level. No one does it that high. And let's be honest, what you mentioned, he might be the smartest player in terms of looking at this as a game. His ability over generations to adapt his game has been impressive. And his ability as a dad bod fat piece of ass to stay competitive in competitions against younger folk is very applaud-worthy. He's become a fabric of the show where very few could have deserved what I mentioned, having a statue built and be named a coach. If you have him at one, I think I'm going to have him at two in my list, but very, very well-deserved. If you had him at four, I would have ended the show, but thank you. Keep going.
I agree with you. Three is the lowest, and that's why I said four is the highest I could personally put Sandra, because I couldn't put her over Boston Rob or any of the other two people remaining. So the one I have at number two, I'm starting to get the feeling that maybe you missed this person's prime and don't realize how good she was at her peak, but it's Parvati Shallow. She, the season she won, Fans versus Favorites, is actually questionable whether she deserved it or Amanda Kimmel deserved it. They got it to the end, and I felt like it could have gone either way. But then to come back out with that giant target on her back as someone who just won it and play in Heroes versus Villains, and in my view, appear to deserve to win it when they gave it to Sandra, she made some of the most amazing moves in that season. And it doesn't hurt. I know we're going to talk about our favorite seasons later. It doesn't hurt that Fans versus Favorites and Heroes versus Villains are both all-time seasons, and she went all the way through all of them. She, for a while, held the record for most number of days spent on Survivor. Her first season, she came in and was your classic, doesn't know what she's doing, just here to look good and flirt with guys. And she I forget exactly where she got eliminated, but she did okay in the game, but nothing special. For her to then, during her time off, figure out how to play the game and play it as perfectly as she did, those two seasons that she played almost back to back, she was just a force and just controlling the game and just making brilliant moves. There's a classic scene where she had two idols and played neither of them for herself and instead played them for two of her alliance mates who were being targeted when she wasn't. She read the room perfectly, and it's one of the all-time great tribal councils, and she's just a legend. And I think Parvati at two, Boston Rob at three, they're almost interchangeable. That's a really tough call for me.
And I think she deserves a chance at number one. I did miss her prime, but to see her come back in this, which could have been a victory lap performance, instead, she showed everything, Rask. I mean, she's brilliant. She's able to use the friendly, flirtatious side to get ahead if she wants. She probably is a Boston Rob level thinker of how this game actually works. And to be on that level, you have to know people and be able to understand how they tick. She's a good, obviously great shape and a good, challenge threat.
Yeah, that threat. Solid in the challenges. And I think she had like baby, a month or two before coming out for this season. That's crazy.
Pretty insane. Crazy. All right, Rask, hit me with the horns, Monty. What do you got for number one, the best player of all time?
So I think everyone at this point knows who it is by process of elimination. This person could not possibly be lower than number three at this point. And really, I think it's getting close to an ironclad case for number one, Tony Vlachos.
Yes.
I mean, prior to this last season, my top five probably looks something like Parvati or Boston Rob for one, Sandra at three, and I don't even know if I'd put Tony in my top five based on how bad his second performance on this show was. But to win it twice in three tries, playing the kind of game that he does, there are only two-time champions, and if I'm knocking Sandra as well, her two wins were both a little Tony's two wins were both spectacular against tough groups of opponents. The way that he plays the game, and I think there was a moment toward the end of this last season, it might have even been part of the two-hour-long finale, where he's telling the other people, he's telling Sarah and the other people in his alliance, this person has an idol, and everyone else is like, no, you're wrong, Tony, and he's right. And then this person doesn't have an idol, and they're all like, oh, no, that person might have an idol, Tony, and he's right again. His ability to read people, that's the cop thing, the detective thing. He can sniff it out. He will lie to you, and even though you Everyone suspects him of lying. They somehow fall for it ultimately anyway. He's just an amazing player, and I think a pretty clear-cut choice for the greatest player of all time after what he just pulled off.
I know, and it's almost like, and I agree with you, and it's almost like you want to go, oh, that's recency bias, but it's not. Just the fact alone that he won this super all-star season and did it the way he did is a huge sort of, stake in his corner to being the potential GOAT. But I look at so many things, the innovation, the creation of the Spy Shack, stuff like that. He is, while I respect like Rob and Parvati, even Sandra for being great thinkers, I feel like nobody is thinking harder than Tony every second of every episode. And he doesn't seem to get worn down by the stress of that. He's excellent in challenges. His ability to be almost the kind of guy that's so, he doesn't hide his danger. He's outwardly dangerous. He's the best idol finder and searcher that we've ever seen in this show. And he doesn't hide that, yet to be able to survive and not survive in a way where I'm going to get the necklace every single time to try to just barely survive, even though everybody would have voted me out. He survives in different ways, almost showing people his villainry and then kind of talking them into supporting it or coming on board with it. He's incredible. He is next level, second generation, whatever, new school, but he's absolutely incredible. I would love to see him rest. He could easily walk away now and be the best ever, but I would love to see him get a couple victory lap opportunities in some themed seasons to see if he can pull this off again, because it's so hard to do it when there's a crazy target on your back, because there's no reason why people shouldn't eliminate you on day one, episode two, episode three. You should kind of be gone after right away. Yeah, for him to take a great rising player in Sarah Lucina and almost use her, but yet manipulate and keep her down through the grounds of friendship and love, it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Yeah. And in addition to being the greatest player of all time, he's the hardest working player of all time. He plays the game the hardest. He doesn't need to sleep. He gets like no sleep, and he's working all night when everyone else is sleeping. It's just amazing to watch. I don't know how he keeps his sanity under those conditions, but he is built for the game. And I think it's remarkable what he pulled off. And yeah, I don't know if he could possibly, if he could come back another time and somehow make another deep run, it would be remarkable because the odds are so stacked against him. But I was part of a survivor pool going into this season with some old coworkers. And when somebody picked Tony Vlachos as to put on their fantasy team, when the whole thing was you have to have the winner to win, that was what we were drafting for. I berated them and I was like, well, you picked the one person who has no chance of winning this game. And then he goes out and wins it. It's amazing.
Yeah, shout out to him as well. All right, Rask, I got to try to keep us under 2 hours here. I mean, this is awesome and getting ridiculous. People that could have been on that list but wasn't, I'm going to throw out Natalie Anderson, right? She came from Amazing Race.
Strong.
She was a 20. And for her to be able to set herself aside, she's a physical beast. She's mentally tough as balls. I feel like she could win any season under any circumstance and may continue to get that chance to add a second victory.
Yeah, she's a solid choice. The two that I had as my just miss that I considered were Sarah Lucina, who has now played it three times and basically only ever lost to Tony in a sense. Like, she won one out of three and made a good run the other two, and just really has a pretty complete game we can see at this point. And my other one is Yul Kwan, who, yeah, he wasn't that great in his return now, but he's kind of old and washed. He's about our age, which is old and washed. But his first season, he took strategy to another level the way he played his first season, and his showdown with Ozzy in the final two is the stuff of legend. So I love me some Yul Kwan. I think he's close to this list, but ultimately, like I said, I couldn't put anyone above Sandra for that five spot. I've got her about as low as you could possibly have her. So that's my top five and who almost made it.
Let's quickly go through this because we touched on it a lot. The idea of the greatest single season performance. Kim's divorced year is up there for all the reasons we said. She willed that to happen. She used an old school approach. And so did Rob, as we mentioned, right around that. I want to give Rob even more credit, though, because that Redemption Island win at 22 – again, like when you come in, I think they only had two returning players that year, maybe. When
right,
you come
it was in, Rob and Russell each had a tribe, yeah.
When you come in with that sort of like, you're the guy that's there to teach everyone else how to play, but you're also the guy they're going to target instantly. That was next level brainwashing. Those are my two choices. I'm a little bit more limited than you. Do you have anyone else that deserves in discussion along with Tony Vlachos' two wins for best single season performance?
So this is, I did not prepare a list on this particular one, but I can just go off the top of my head that yes, it's Boston Rob and Kim Spradlin that stand out, and Tony's wins were incredible. And the only other one I'd throw in the mix would be in Tokenshin's JT, who was the good old boy everybody loved, but he also played a brilliant game, had a great two-man team with him and Stephen Fishback, and then he gets the clean sweep of like 10 votes to nothing over Fishback in the final. Now, JT got worse every time he played the game. His he chipped away at his legacy. He's Kurt Cobain living into his 40s and putting out absolute crap like soundtrack songs or whatever as he gets a little older. But that first season, JT was totally dominant.
Yeah, Roy Jones Jr. after 2005, basically. Yes. Shout out to that. I did also have a lot of respect. Where was that here? The Tyson win, 27 mm-hmm. Blood versus Water. Again, it's hard to win at that situation when you're a guy who has a lot of history, and he came in and played a near perfect game, won 7-1 in the votes over Monica Culpepper and Jervis. Maybe there's two goats with him there, and he played it perfectly. So shout out.
Yeah, he played great. Jeremy Collins, when he won in 31. Was it Second Chances, he played a phenomenal game. Yeah,
season 31, Cambodia.
Cambodia. Okay. But I think it was Cambodia, but it was initially billed as like second. It was the one where you got voted to out of a group of players to come back on. And he played great. He's a great player. He's someone you probably put in your top 10 all time as well. But yeah, these are some of the names that played. And let's go. Ethan Zahn in season 3 played a near perfect game for what the game was at the time.
And in over 3 appearances has established himself as one of the game's icons and faces you think of instantly. So, why don't we go there? The idea of a true hero, because part of what makes the show great is the entertainment factor, cheering for somebody. Can you give me a quick 5 on who you believe to be the your favorite players of all time?
All right, so I was viewing this as most entertaining players. It's not quite favorite, right, but it's close to favorite. It's in that, the same ballpark.
It's in that realm where it's not so much about winning and losing. It's about what right. you can add to the episode, which is a big part of us watching for so long.
Right. So I have a spoiler before I hit my list, and I feel weird about this, but I got to come right out with it. There are no women on my list. And I don't know if that says something about me or about the casting or about how Survivor edits women. I don't know, but I couldn't quite find any women to crack my top 5 most entertaining. You know, there are some that are in the Sandra's in the discussion. Ceri Fields, Jerry, the villain from season 2, Australian yes. Outback, Jerry Manthe,
yes,
Lunch
Voice.
Lady Denise. If you remember her, maybe you weren't watching that season. She was China, I believe. I think you weren't watching. Lunch Lady Denise is something special, but I couldn't quite put any in my top 5.
Oh, who was the mother? The young mother? A couple of years ago, she voted out her mom. She was.
Oh, girl. Her name, it's not Ceri, but it's something like Ceri. Why can't
Sierra.
I think of
it? Rask.
Sierra, yes. Thank you. There you go. Sierra Easton, that's right. Yeah,
very
yeah,
likable.
Yeah. I don't know that she's super entertaining. And by the way, the whole voting out her mom thing is the most overrated moment in the history of the show. Her mom was going home no matter what. All she did was go along with the crap. It's not like she made the deciding vote on her mom. But all right, anyway. So here's my top 5, which is all dudes. And as I look at it closely, all white dudes. Boy, I'm going to get canceled for this. my number 5, Jonathan Penner. I love that guy. I find him so entertaining. Cook Islands was his first season. And then he came back a few times. He came back was he on Fans versus Favorites or Heroes versus Villains? One of those. And then he came back again on the season where they brought back people who'd been popular players who'd been medevaced from the game. And he got to run a tribe on that. And he's just one of the great confessional soundbite type guys in the history of the show. I love Jonathan Penner. And he appeared on Seinfeld once. So
all right.
Yeah, got to make out with Elaine.
Shout out to that. Who else you got on favorites?
Number 4, Tyson Apostle. You already hit him. Just one-liners. Does anyone compare to Tyson for funny one-liners?
No, and he has like a Zen approach that's always really interesting to the game as well. So he's fantastic.
Right. So number 3 is the greatest player of all time, and I would say the third most entertaining of all time, Tony Vlacha. So much fun to watch.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah to that.
All right, so number 2, the greatest villain the game has ever known, who injected all this life into it in the mid-seasons when it was flagging, Russell Hantz. Love him or hate him, he is supremely entertaining at all times.
Shout out to that indeed, yes.
And my number 1, now this one is a little more... he probably wouldn't be the most popular pick as the most entertaining player ever, but for me, I love me some Rob Cesternino, not just because of the podcast, although that doesn't hurt, but that season six in the Amazon, the way that he played made that one of the all-time great seasons. He's in the greatest never to win conversation along with Ceri and Kelly Wentworth and Amanda Kimmel and players like that. He really absolutely deserved to win, except at the final three, he lost the immunity and they had to get rid of him. But he, great player and so much fun to watch with the way that he invented the idea of like jumping from alliance to alliance week after week.
And I did want to shout out Denise Stapley, you know, the old mom with the abs. She's a very good player that you know, wins despite she figures things out. She's a good player. All right. My favorite is Tony without question. But in that group of favorites, I'm a Cochran guy. I loved when he won that
I thought
season.
About him. Yeah.
Shout out to him. He figured out how to be amusingly annoying and nerdy, but figured it out. And he, you know, the growth as a player was great. Ozzy is so damn entertaining because, Rest, there are very few people who can potentially backdoor wins. And that means where everyone's trying to get you out, but you're finding idols, you're winning challenges. And his ability to stay needed for his fishing ability, yet always be so dangerous to the tribe at any point. Great player to watch. One of my favorites. You got anything to say about him?
I don't find him as entertaining as you do. And there are some obvious holes in his strategic game, but there are certain, the survival elements and the challenge competition elements. He's as good as anyone who's ever played.
My second favorite player of all time, Coach Benjamin Wade. And the reason is because he has top five potential. He's got the mind for it. But he'll make a bad decision. So he's so vulnerable. He's so emotional within that vulnerability. And he's one of those great characters who creates a character for himself that he believes in to sort of psych himself up as the Dragon Slayer. I love me some Coach Wade.
So he is number one on my just missed my top five list. He's, you know, you can love him or hate him. But I think when you look at sort of the insane players from Survivor, and not that he's certifiably insane, but the guys with a screw loose a little bit, who are kind of delusional in some way. Like you look at a Philip Shepherd, he was the guy, the specialist.
Yes.
Right. So he's like on the other side of that line where he is so bonkers that he's kind of annoying. Coach Wade is bonkers in an entertaining way. Yes. And one of the first players that they sort of edited to make fun of him. But had a lot of fun with it. And I find him very entertaining while occasionally annoying. And I'll also just throw in one other name of a runner up, from a season that you were not watching, but Yao Man Chan was this little Asian guy, who played a great game and got pretty deep and then got voted out because he was clearly going to win if they let him go all the way to the end. It was the Fiji season, I believe, and just a really entertaining, lovable character.
So I want to shout out that other small Asian man from recent seasons. Do you remember his name?
Tai Trang.
Tai Trang is
with
one
the
of
eyebrows.
My, one of my favorite players of all time. Love that guy. Also wanted to shout out Rupert. I had a love-hate relationship with him, but at times he's a really strong character you can't take your eyes off of. He's a creeper. Quickly, I wanted to hit up what you mentioned on Philip Shepherd, where I'm going to get into villains in a second, but there are those people that you love to hate, not in a villainy sense that they're there to shake up the game and screw it up, but they're so annoying or weird or freaky. Philip Shepherd, the specialist, is at the top of that list. Here's a sample.
People like you can't stand the truth. What did Jack Nicholson say to Tom Cruise? Son, you can't stand the truth. You can't take the truth. So that's what I'm saying to her. You can't.
Philip, that was not how that that quote went. Do we have that here? I don't know. Probably. All right, moving on. You can't handle the truth. Also in that realm, okay? Do you remember that freak Debbie, that lady that was on a couple times in recent seasons?
Debbie Wanner. Yes.
Here's a sample of her.
I have a bad attitude because I'm sick of defending myself. I took gymnastics for 10 damn minutes. I'm loyal. I was loyal to you lately, like utterly. And you crushed my heart.
You crush my heart line. You could see Satan come out of her as she said it. I think Johnny Fairplay is both a villain and one of those people that you're like, cringe, get him off my screen. I hate him. My favorite in this category, and he almost made my top five favorite list. You could think of him as a villain, but he's such a schlub that it's hard to put him in there. Brandon Hance is one of the most interesting play. If he was on more, Rask, I would be so more entertained. You remember here's a sample of the greatest meltdown in Survivor history.
Stop talking about yourself. Boston Rob took you to the end of the game. You didn't do anything. You were made fun of, and you come here and you tell me don't bite the hand that feeds you? I feed myself.
He feeds himself. We had Probst giving him the massage.
Yes,
of course,
yes.
You remember that season? He hated all the hot chicks because they were threatening to break up his marriage because he was lusting after them. That guy, Rask, whether you hate him, whether you cringed at him, you watched him. Shout out to Brandon Hans.
He's the only player that I could say, like, watching from my couch at home, I was scared. I was scared for everybody on the island about what could possibly happen. He was not all there. That's a good one. Yeah, you hit on a bunch of the great villains.
John Rocker, a great villain.
Yeah.
Do you want to label the greatest villain as Russell Hantz a little higher than Sandra? They are the great villains of this show.
Yeah, I think Hantz has got to be the most hated overall player in the history of the show. That his legacy as a villain, and he really leans into it. Absolutely. And I'll just say on Johnny Fairplay, there's some, his second appearance, you know, was pretty forgettable, but the dead grandma lie,
yes,
is still gotta be like a top three all time Survivor scene. It was the most diabolical thing anyone tried in the first 10 years of the show. And shout out to him for that.
So here is the universal all time greatest, both Survivor moment, most iconic moment, greatest put down, greatest one liner. Here it is from Susan Hawk. If anyone ever votes, they always vote this as not just one of the greatest Survivor moments or the number one, but like a top 10 all time TV moment I've heard, Rask.
You will not get my vote. My vote will go to Richard. And I hope that is the one vote that makes you lose the money. If it's not, so be it. I'll shake your hand and I'll go on from here. But if I were ever pass you along in life again and you were laying there dying of thirst, I would not give you a drink of water. I would let the vultures take you and do whatever they want with you. With no ill regrets. I plead to the jury tonight.
That's Susan Hawk sending Kelly Wigglesworth to hell in season
one.
And you
didn't even get into the rat and the snake there.
Yeah, there was what do you want to pick there? So is there any moment on par with it? Because we used to have the black rule in 90s music where black's not your favorite Pearl Jam song. But when talking about Pearl Jam songs, you have to basically say it's the best thing they've ever written, like Stairway to Heaven for Zeppelin. It's like, that wouldn't be in my top five favorite Zeppelin song, but is there a better song? You know, probably not. So that's the moment where it's like nothing will ever top that. It was like so cold, so early too, in the genealogy of this show. Are there any other moments that deserve to be in that discussion?
I mean, no, I think that has to be the number one most iconic moment. It's fascinating for her to hear her saying, I hope my vote is the deciding vote, because it was, but also Greg asking Richard and Kelly to pick a number between 1 and 10 was also the deciding vote. It shows you just the levels and the randomness of the game. But Sue Hawk's speech there is the number one most iconic Survivor moment. I would put probably Johnny Fairplay coming up with the plan during the family visit to have his friend say that his grandmother is dead.
And scooping in the fire. Season 3, maybe scooping in the fire. It was a major
season. Season 2, yeah, scooping in the fire was iconic.
Killing the pig in the same season, right?
Right, right. I love Australian Outback. That's the season that got me hooked on the show. I feel like most of the other iconic moments are just iconic tribal council strategy moments, like I was talking about with Parvati playing the two idols, or the season with Malcolm Freeberg where he has three idols and gives them to all
yes.
of his boys but they didn't go anywhere with it. They weren't able to last beyond that one, but moments like that are up there. But I think top two, I think it's hard to put anything above Sue Hawk at number one and the dead grandma lie at number two.
And I do want to throw in the Tony and Lucina fire battle from this most recent season 40.
Good one.
For
yeah.
drama and like that, like edge of my seat, edge of my friggin' seat. Shout out to that. Quickly here, Rask, as we wind down, and I've held you so long, but this is fantastic content.
I could go three more hours, BC.
Yeah, Jeff Horn was a real man. Rask, is there a way to count down what are the best seasons? What do you got?
Yeah, I got a list here. I actually I have five runners up too, but we'll see if we bother with those. But here's my top five. Number five, Samoa, Russell's first season. Maybe not quite top five most entertaining, but I'm putting it in here because it was so important, because that season gave the show another 20 seasons of life that it might not have had if that season hadn't come along. So that's my number five.
Quickly, I wanted to shout out Russell in that season that Boston Rob won. It was Russell's third and final appearance. He was voted out early, but remember he created that that faction of hot chicks who did his work for him, and he would sit back like a Don. That was a great TV moment. All right, keep going.
So number four, I'm going with my favorite season of the early-ish seasons, Amazon, season six, the Rob Sesternino season. Also had Jenna and Heidi stripping for peanut butter. Classic moment. A little something for you to revisit, BC, if you missed that season.
Ethan Zahn knows about that season. Yes, yes.
Heidi, by the way, married to Cole Hamels, a Major League Baseball pitcher, former Phillies 2008 World Series MVP. So that Amazon is just an amazing season. They came up with the controversial women versus men theme to start it. But as the tribes mixed, it just developed into a great season. Number three, Survivor Cagayan, Tony's first season. You also had Chaos Cass and Spencer and Wu and just all these great characters. And Tony running the show and becoming, you know, the first new player since Russell Hance to just like take everybody by storm. So I got that at number three. Number two, Micronesia Fans versus Favorites, which had the amazing ice cream scooper Eric giving up his necklace that they still replay 15 years later, whatever it's been, as the biggest mistake in the history of the show. But the whole season was great. It started the very first episode. You had the fans tribe, and they blindsided one of the big meatheads on the very first vote, which you don't get rid of your physical beast on the first elimination. They did it on the first vote. It was just one of those things like, oh, this is how it's going to be. And the season never slowed down. But number one for me, Heroes versus Villains. You had the early weeks were marked by Rob versus Russell in the villains camp, just going at each other. You had Tyson basically voting himself out by miscalculating everything. You had JT writing a note to Russell when they were on opposite tribes and slipping it to him and talking about how they're going to work together when they get together. And Russell pretended to go for it and then just totally turned it around on him and screwed JT. Just an amazing cast. It really was a perfect season, except that Sandra got the win when it seemed to me like Parvati deserved it. But that's my favorite season, Heroes versus
final
Villains.
Final three, Sandra, Parvati, and Russell Hance. That's a iconic. Yeah. And it was a 6-3 victory for Sandra. Iconic final three right there.
Yeah, great stuff. Definitely, if you're going to go fill in some of your gaps and rewatch some seasons, Fans versus Favorites and Heroes versus Villains are the two you got to see.
And I'm going to put season 40, Winners at War. Some people have said that might be the best season ever. Every week was like, wow, it was big. It was big.
I agree to a point.
It's steroids. It's meant to have fireworks every episode. But
right. Yeah. I think it started great. And then unfortunately, as they voted out all of the old school players, the second half of the season wasn't as good because so many of the best personalities were on the edge of extinction instead of in the main game.
That's fair. And here's a conversation that normally is in line with this, because Rask, sometimes, you know, when your favorite players get voted out and there's no second chance island, there's nothing like that. It's tough. It's tougher when someone really attractive gets voted out too early, Rask. This is the Patreon portion of the show, Rask, that will probably get us fired. But do you have a favorite piece of eye candy in the history of Survivor?
This is dangerous. Now I have to make sure that my wife is not going to listen to this podcast. Probably not an issue. If I don't tell her it exists, she won't know. So I just can't share it on Facebook, only on Twitter. Boy, I would say, so you remember Cagayan, the season that Tony won, there was, and I can't even think of her name
Morgan McLeod. She's in the running for the goat. Okay.
Yeah. She was easy on the eyes. Let's just say that.
All right.
There are some early ones. I had a little thing for Amber off Australian Outback season. But by the time they got to All Stars and she was with Rob, it was fading a little bit.
Like college look Amber, I think, is right up there with prime Liz Filarczyk as like your first two girl next door type of deals, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was a big fan of Amber. I'm trying to think of which other ones along the way I had like a significant crush on.
Can I shout out a few for you? Well, first of all, Mrs. Raskin.
We both know it did exist.
I don't know what you're talking about. Well, seriously.
The podcast exists. This conversation exists. Here's the deal here. Here's who I believe is in the – let me give you honorable mentions here, okay?
Okay.
The two that I mentioned there, Kelly Wigglesworth to me is right outside looking in on the
Kelly Wigglesworth.
No, sorry,
from season one.
The other one, Wentworth.
Kelly Wentworth
is
okay.
on the outside
yeah.
looking
yeah, I like
in
her.
Potential
yeah.
goat status. Do you remember Angie Layton from Philippines?
Angie Layton. I can't picture
her. Store that for later. Do you remember Candace Smith from Tonkan Cheens?
No, I don't know. I don't know. I'm getting washed in terms of the old bank up here. I don't know. I'm forgetting all these.
Brenda Lowe from both fan favorites.
Oh, Brenda Lowe. Yeah, yeah. She was pretty. Okay.
All right,
here's
the three I think are in the real discussion here. Morgan McLeod Cagayan, Chelsea Meisner, One World. I think she wins in the end. And Alicia Holden from Brains versus Braun.
So do you know Alicia Holden has a boxing connection?
Is she related to Tony Holden?
She is Tony Holden's daughter.
Wow. I think I knew that when that episode
aired. And I think you think she's hotter than I do, because I don't remember her being one of my all-time favorites. But
Okay. A big Chelsea Meisner fan. Shout out to that. you can do with that what you want with that, okay? Thank you. Morgan McLeod in the discussion. Thank you as well. As we close here, finally, Raskin, I thank you for your time. The innovation. Some have worked, some haven't. I like the tokens the fire coins that they're having now. It does add something to it. I have liked at times the use of a second chance island. Although Rask, I don't like it. It does take away that feeling that we just talked about when someone you wanted to see or you thought could win just got blindsided or got ganged up on because they're too powerful. I like that element. That's what makes the show hard. The idea that you can't be too strong looking. You can't be too clever. You have to dumb yourself down to a degree to try to sneak your way to a win. And when you have that second chance, I don't know. It's created some good elements, some bad. Is there anything that you hate the most that has been added to the show or anything you feel like can be added that could give the show even more life after 40 seasons?
Well, first of all, I'll say that I'm in line with you on the any sort of Edge of Extinction, Redemption Island, anything like that, where I'm cool with them having tried things, experimented, give it a shot. But in general, the purity of the game, the idea of you get voted out, your time on the game is over, other than perhaps you're serving in the jury or something, but you're out of the competition. That's always the best version of the game. So I generally don't like those twists that keep people in the game after they've been voted out. The best innovation from the history of the show, I think the most consistently rewarding one for the viewers, was when they first started putting hidden immunity idols out there. It's just, it's hard to believe that the game once existed without those, because they're such a part of the fabric of the game now. I think it was better when you needed a clue to find them, at least. And maybe there are too many idols and advantages in the game these days, but certainly that's something Survivor came up with that worked and keeps working season after season. A lot of bad innovations that they tried. There was something called the Medallion of Power that lasted like half a season, and I can't even remember what it did, but it was a complete disaster. I think Edge of Extinction, I'm okay that they tried it once. I was annoyed that they tried it a second time, except it made sense in this Winners at War season to keep those cast members around longer. They didn't want you to lose Boston Rob early in the season, but I still don't like it. How do you feel about the Final Four fire-making challenge that they've added? Because I thought it was kind of a cool twist at first to give the person who's running the game a better chance to make it to the end. But I feel like we've seen every iteration of it now, and it's played out.
I'm going to counter you. It's perfect. Why? Because I feel like we've gone too far away from the actual survivor element. I talked to that with Ethan. There's too many food challenges, right? It's not about, like, there's too many ways to fuel yourself. It's not about, can you actually outlast somebody physically anymore? And that's one of those rare times where fire making is part of the whole survival idea. So having that as a potential final thing to me is great, because there's so much drama in it. There is skill involved as opposed to just being voted out by opinion. And it gives you the option, Rask, of putting things in your own hands, of saying there's somebody out there who's so valuable they would beat me in a vote. So my only way to get them out is to outfire them. To me, I love that innovation. I'm in on it. I can do away with coins. I could do away with islands, but give me that.
All right. I agree that it has worked pretty well so far. I just think we might be reaching the point where it's time to shake it up again and get rid of that. And speaking of that, the shake up at the end, I hate that they always have a final three now. You remember the Cagayan season that Tony won?
Yes.
They surprised everybody by going back to final two. I think if the show was smart, they would have it that nobody ever quite knows, and it varies from season to season, whether it's two or three, so you can't totally plan that out. The final three, you always get one person who gets no votes. Sometimes the final two is more dramatic. I think of Yule versus Oz. Actually, Yule versus Ozzy was a final three. It's just the third person didn't get any votes. So maybe scratch that as an example. But point is, I want to see them mix that up. Some final two, some final three. Let that vary from season to season.
All right, quickly, I want them to bring back something that my wife and kids hate, but I love it. Remember at the end of the season, after the final breakfast that they have, they would go up to the top of the mountain, and there would be a setup of all the players that were voted off, and they would say something about each one for like 15 seconds. I love that because
it's so uncomfortable.
It reminded you who was in the season. You remembered all that. That is great. I am all for that. I think they've innovated greatly on the idea of bringing back older players. Sometimes all older player seasons, sometimes a mixture. Bringing in celebrities has been a great innovation, and I think they should do that more, Rask, because it's interesting. It puts a target on their back. Sometimes they pretend if no one picks them out that they're a regular person. I like that. My main thing to them that they can do and should do is this. Change the location. Not just like get out of the Caribbean island – or not Caribbean. Get out of the idea of tropical island. I would like to see how this could work in – a forest in the wintertime. I would like to see how this could work in a desert. I would like, because the one thing Naked and Afraid, which was obviously inspired in some ways by Survivor, Naked and Afraid is a kind of ridiculous show, but it's interesting at the same time. They have many different setups in there, right? It's desert, it's swamps. Like, I would like to see a little bit more of an aspect put back on the physical survival of it all. I'm not really even into the competitions. Like, I tune out when it comes to the time for, like, the challenge. I'm not a challenge guy. I don't need crazy puzzles and challenges. Give me a little bit more physical challenges where they fight. I like those ones. And give me a little bit more of let's change the scenery. That might be the best thing.
I could go for that, and especially if they're going to attempt to do a season 41 this summer, as they're still claiming they're going to try to do, it's probably pretty hard to get out of the country. I would wonder if, coming up with X number of acres of land somewhere in the Midwest that's like untouched and bubble it off from the world and film it like right here in America somewhere might be the only option they have. I don't think they'll ever do the cold winter season because Survivor lives for people having to strip down to their underwear and bikinis. So I don't think they're ever going to do that. But there are a few things that I'd like to see them work on. Come up with somehow some kind of mechanism to avoid the two or three best looking women always getting voted out in the first three or four episodes. They got to figure that out. Maybe expand it to 90 minutes instead of 60 if CBS will allow them, because I felt like this past season there were some episodes where the strategy was just cut out because we had to show Edge of Extinction and we had to show this and that, and they're cutting out challenges. There are reward challenges that we never get to see. There's just too much. Maybe expand the show to 90 minutes.
So on that point, real quick, Big Brother, I don't watch it, but it gives you too much. There's multiple episodes a week, and you can watch the live 24-hour stream of just hearing them talk. I think Survivor needs something extra to add on, because it does leave you wanting more, but I almost want to hear more of the fun moments between them or the arguments than just strategy in your face all the time, all right?
I
can't keep you here any longer. We both have families to get back to. Thank you for going on this journey with me. This was epic. This was epic.
Thank you for having me, Brian. And I could have gone another 2 hours if you wanted to.
I'm right there with you. And by the way, just real quickly, Angie Layton is in the GOAT discussion. Look that up.
Okay, I'll look that up.
Let's not forget Prime Parvati. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
And the listeners can't see this, but Brian was really leaning in close there to get his point across with all that.
Thank you. We out, Rask. They can follow you at Eric Raskin on things.
That's right. Yep. On Twitter at Eric Raskin, and maybe check out usbets.com if you're into the world of gambling.
Yeah, absolutely. Check out the Moneymaker Effect. Great book. Raskin, we out.
It's the NFL offseason, but on Pick 6, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, the football season never stops. Hosts Will Brinson, John Breach, and Tyler Sullivan are joined by analysts like Brady Quinn, Leslie Deuceable, Katie Mox, and RJ White to keep you in the loop on everything happening around the league. Whether it's free agents signing with new teams, the all-important NFL draft, or schedule release day, Pick 6 has you covered. As the face of the league changes with every team move and player pickup this spring, Pick Six is a must listen. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and anywhere podcasts are found.